Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, June 27th, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening live over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140, and our participant code is 385698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. And also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab up on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to open up tonight with tonight's scripture is Proverbs chapter 8, verses 1 through 17. And the focus of our program tonight is going to be on justice. You know, if you recall, on January 1st, 2016, which I believe was a Monday, January 1st, and we opened up the first of the year, and we declared this the year of justice, 2016. Let's read the scriptures, and then we'll talk a little bit about that. So Proverbs 8, chapter 8, verses 1 through 17, I think I'm going to read. Doeth not wisdom cry, and understanding put forth her voice? She standeth in the top of high places, by the way, in the places of the paths. She crieth at the gates, at the entry of the city, at the coming in, at the doors. Unto you, O men, I call, and my voice is to the sons of men. O ye simple, understand wisdom, and ye fools, be ye of an understanding heart. Hear, for I will speak of excellent things, and the opening of my lips shall be right things. For my mouth shall speak truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the words of my mouth are in righteousness. There is nothing forward or perverse in them. They are all plain to him that understandeth, and right to them that find knowledge. Receive my instruction, and not silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is better than rubies, and all the things that may be desired are not to be compared to it. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and find out knowledge of witty inventions. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride, and arrogancy, and the evil way, and the forward mouth do I hate. Counsel is mine, and sound wisdom. I am understanding. I have strength. By me kings reign, and princes decree justice. By me princes rule, and nobles, even all the judges of the earth. I love them that love me, and those that seek me early shall find me. Okay, that was Proverbs chapter 8, verses 1 through 17. And again, the focus here of our night is going to be on justice. By me, kings reign, and princes decree justice. You know, in our judicial process, it is the people who is the king of the court, by way of the jury, the grand jury, and the trial jury. They represent the king of the court, which, of course, is the creator. And we rule by his principles as princes, ultimately, as kings. The king of kings is the Lord. As I mentioned earlier, that we have declared 2016 the year of justice. And the reason why we did that is because there seems to be so much talk and focus on 2016 being the year of collapse. And we indeed, if that is true, we indeed definitely must get ahead of that and be able to get into the courts before that happens. So we've been doing everything we can to accomplish that goal, to get the people back control of the courts through the juries, whereas we, the people, administer to the people coming in as jurists and as grand jurists, and make sure that we prevent those people from being tainted by being instructed by a judge or by a lawyer. The people must rule in the case on the facts and with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy, and that's what we need to teach the people. You know, we get 8 hours with the people. Any jury that goes through orientation, you know, they go through an orientation time period, and it's done in one day. So we, the people, once we get into power and authority by taking control of the administration of the juries in every county across the nation, these are the principles we're going to teach the people. So we have a plan on what it is that we need to show the people and prepare the people for the judgment that they're about to go in and make a judgment, and how serious that judgment is, and how careful they have to really evaluate what's going on and consider the facts, and also understand that they have nullification powers, and they have to rule righteously and justly. And again, so that's what we need to do, to orientate these people in order to be in that kind of a position. Now, we have heard that in September or August or sometime towards the end of this year, that they will not be able to cover the checks for Social Security. Those are the words I understand. I have not heard this directly, so I am saying that I'm hearing this secondhand from numerous sources, though. We should go out and search that out to confirm this, but in any event, you know, the word is out that President Obama had made that mention, that it's going to be tough for them. I'm not sure exactly how he said it, but in a way, it's going to be tough for them to be able to cover the checks. We've heard another rumor, which we have not been able to confirm at all, but that the Federal Reserve has been foreclosed on May 28, 2016. So it's just a month or two ago that this happened. And if that is true, then, of course, what we're hearing that President Obama said concerning covering the checks is understandable, because they won't be able to print out any more money. And so that causes a problem. We also see what's going on in Europe, okay, and where England is backing out of the union there, and they're moving away from the euro. And we saw the markets here in America, you know, take a big dive. So things are happening, you know, and we can only watch, pray, wait, and work like a dog to get things going to where we have to get them going. We have to get the word out. We've been meeting on Thursdays, and we'll continue to meet on Thursdays for the purpose of organizing the nation And I want to encourage everyone to get involved and participate in organizing the nation, in building committees of safety in every county across America. And it starts with your county and your state. And so please, anybody who's not coming to those meetings, we're going to try to keep them short. And it's really going to be like a briefing. You know, the first 10 minutes or so, we'll discuss where we're at, what we're doing concerning our organizing across the nation through the Committee of Safety. But then as we go through that process, the next person coming up and speaking will be someone in one of the other committees. And so we have numerous committees, and each one of those committees will come up and give an account of things, what's going on, where they're going, what their plans are, what they've achieved, what they're looking to, where they're looking to get to, and so on. And so I believe these meetings shouldn't take any more than an hour. As a matter of fact, they might even take a half hour, 45 minutes. We're going to really try to stick to this kind of a plan. Now, over the past weeks, we've been having a meeting really trying to encourage and push and set up the process. So the meetings have been going a little long. They have been posted. You can find the meetings that we have had up on, let's see where it is. I think it's on the Committee of Safety page. If you go to the Committee of Safety, highlight Committee of Safety, come down and click on Committee of Safety, and you get to the page for the Committee of Safety. You'll find the audios of the safety of the committees of safety, and we tried to. I see a couple of these audios have not been, tagged with a title. I'll go back and try to tag the three audios that are not tagged. But the last one we had, which was just last week, the 23rd on Thursday. It was Taking Back America, and people who haven't been coming to these meetings, you should get up there and listen to that. We also, the week before, talked about the power of the Committee of Safety, and people should get up there and listen to these audios and catch up. Only we the people can save America, only the people. Certainly our servants will not and cannot save America. They won't do it. And I can give a list of reasons on what I think, but that's irrelevant. The bottom line is we all know they're not going to do it. They're politicians. It's all about money and power, and that's the big problem. So we do have to be prepared. We have to get ready. Next week, next Monday, is the 4th of July. I believe it's on Monday. Let me take a look to confirm that. Next Monday is the 4th of July. We will be here on the 4th of July. And we hope you will, too. And we hope we'll continue to grow and more people will come. And those who can't listen in live, they can download these programs up on our welcome page. Just click on the welcome page and scroll down a wee bit, and you'll find all of the audios for years that we've been having for years. So you could always catch up there and listen in. Some people can only come in for the first hour. Because maybe they need to go to sleep to go to work the next day or whatever, and they can catch up on the other 2 hours through audio throughout the week. And the opposite is true for the people out west. Some people can't make it on a call in the first hour, but they can download. The first hour is, of course, always the most important hour of our program. So we do all our announcements and teachings, and we have a special speaker, as we've had for quite a few months now, Brent Winters, and we'll continue to have him as long as he would like to continue to teach and bring forth his knowledge of common law and the Constitution. But this week, at the end of this week, next Monday, is the 4th of July. What we did is we wrote a paper. Excuse me. We wrote a paper. If everybody would like to go to our welcome page, nationallibertyalliance.org, and right up on the top of the page, you can click on Declaration of July 4th, 2016. Now, we posted this tonight, and we're going to read this tonight. It's a very short paper. It's only 2 pages, and really it's less than that because there's a lot of footnotes in here. I'm not going to be reading the footnotes. People can get a copy of this, and we are going to be mailing this out this week. And we're going to date it July 4th, 2016, because we have a message to send to the judiciary and also to the marshals, the U.S. Marshals, and we're going to send a copy to this FBI special agents in charge. So they'll all get, and the chief judges of every federal district, so they will all get a hard copy of this paper. And we will start faxing probably tomorrow or possibly tonight, probably tomorrow, we'll start faxing to every elected official that we have a fax number for in America, which is quite a few. So we've got thousands and thousands of fax numbers, and we've got eight lines that fax out. And so everyone of these people are going to get this message. And this is a message from we the people to our servants, ultimately. And we're declaring July 4th, 2016. This is a declaration of July 4th, 2016. We want to really press forward what our founding fathers did for us, the gift that they gave to us through their July 4th, 1776. And so we want to let these people know that we still anticipate liberty in this nation. And so I think what we'll do is we'll just read the paper. So again, if you'd like a copy and would like to follow along, you can get a copy up on nationallibertyalliance.org. Front page, right up on the top, Declaration of July 4th, 2016, PDF. Just click on that to get a PDF copy. Now, again, you know, we're going to get this out, as I mentioned. We're going to mail it. We're going to fax it, get it out to everyone. And we'd like everyone. We're also going to probably put this up on a YouTube. And people will have copies of this. We want to get this out to everyone. We want to push real hard this week. Everyone involved needs to get the message out. The Declaration of our liberty, and the year of justice, ultimately. All right, on the top of the paper, it says the United States District Court for all 94 federal districts. Underneath that, in small print, it says our reason for filing in all U.S. federal district courts, and with our unique case number, which, by the way, is 1776, 1789, 2015. And our unique case number is because of 18 U.S.C. subsection 1961-68, widespread RICO, 18 U.S. Code 2385, advocating overthrow of government, 18 U.S.C. subsection 2384, seditious conspiracy with widespread mutilation, and 18 U.S.C. subsection 2071, failing to file. And so on the top of the paper, it directs the clerk is to file under the case number 1776-1789-2015. We identify ourselves on the top, Quorum Nobis, which ultimately is before us ourselves. It's the King's Bench, before the people. And we identify ourselves as the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, and we give our address here in New York. And it starts off with the cap, Declaration of July 4th, 2016. To all elected and appointed servants from the full bench, directed to the judges of de facto courts and law on all law enforcement agencies. We the people of the United States of America, on March 4th, 1789, birthed a nation, and we the people this July 4th, 2016, ratify that in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Take judicial notice. The 41st Congress acted without constitutional authority, an act of fraud, conspiracy, and subversion against the United States of America. Only the people can ordain and establish laws and governments. Only the people are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights. Governments are not. Consequently, all latter construction upon the Organic Act of 1871 is as null and void as is the Act. Said Act attempted to supplant our Republican form of government that our servants were entrusted to guarantee. Any court resting upon said act is a de facto court. Any judge acting under such fiction of law denies due process and is acting in excess of their judicial authority, in collusion, under color of law, thereby losing judicial immunity. Therefore, any judicial reliance upon said act is injudicious. We, the people, eternally hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, then that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government. Any servant who resists these truths wars against the people. Wherefore, we the people are rising. Critical mass is imminent, as the olive branch sifts away like the sands in an hourglass. Then it's labeled the court, July 4th, 2016. It'll have our seal, the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury seal on it, and signed by the foreman, the grand jury. Okay, this paper is going out, going to start going out in the mail. Well, I'm going to start printing tomorrow, so a lot of them may get out tomorrow, but if not, it'll get out in the mail Tuesday. But we'll try to get it out tomorrow. Now, just to make a point, before we get into some of these things, this costs money. We've been asking for money for quite a few weeks. We're still trying to catch up. Our bills have gotten larger, and we're just not able to catch up on the bills. Nevertheless, we're going to spend the necessary money to get this mailing out and do everything we have to do to get the message out this week. And we're asking everyone else to participate and get this message. Let's get it viral. And hopefully people will come to the website and sign up and get involved. Because, again, only the people can save America. And so we're going to do that out of faith that we're still going to be able to collect enough money to pay our bills. But, again, we're falling behind. The key thing is a stable income. And so we ask for everybody, all our members, we don't require anything. Everything we give and do is free. Both of our courses we have up there is free. All of our education, we have lots of papers. We've written a book on access into the courts. We've written a book on for jurists and for sheriffs and judges on common law. We're writing a book, a handbook, for the purpose of teaching the people and guiding the people in their counties when they become administrators on how to go through the process. And we will continue to be here for advice and information and further education and so on. So everything we've done is free. So we charge nobody anything. Even our habeas corpuses, we do ask, we ask now $75 for as a donation for sending out habeas corpus. We moved that up from 60 to 75 because we really just need to get more donations in order to pay the bills. And it does cost quite a bit of money to get this paperwork together, to mail it out. Some of it is certified. It's a series of papers that go out. And this is only for people. We do habeas corpus is only for people who are in jail or in court under threat of going to jail to get them out of that court system. And we also do it for people who have lost their children through family courts. So those are the only two types of cases we take. But we do also take mortgage foreclosures, and we have a process for that. Now, we've had quite a few people go through that mortgage foreclosure process where we've sent out papers. To my knowledge, none of them have sent in any money. I don't think when Linda was handling this, she didn't mention to them because she thought it was less of a process or whatever, but she just didn't mention to those people. So, if you could send in some kind of a donation, it'll be helpful. But we also haven't finished that process. There's a second phase to that, which requires that you do a second affidavit. We require a first affidavit to get the process going and to alert the court and the sheriff and others of this violation of people's right, violation of their due process. And the second letter, papers that we sent out to the sheriff and to the court and others has to go out, but we can't send that out until we get another affidavit from the people who have started this process. And I don't believe anybody has sent anything in. I guess it was never explained to them properly enough that there needs to be a second affidavit, which means that the sheriff is not going to help them. And then we're going to put that sheriff under some more pressure, and also the judge in whatever court this is involved. It could be even a town court that's just doing an eviction because the people, you know, the mortgage companies are coming in as owners and kicking people out as if they're tenants. And that's how they're getting away with this and bypassing really the process through the sheriff taking the property. So that's all explained in our paperwork. But anyway, those are the cases we take. And we don't really get involved in any other cases. But we've done, I think, 28 cases on the habeas corpuses, and we've got about 150 cases that all need to be updated. So anybody that's got a case in, you need to get updated. Make contact with intake at nationallibertyalliance.org. I would suggest very strongly, we've reduced the paperwork requirement. The paperwork requirement was way too much. There was way too much information being collected. We didn't need all that information. But you can go to our everyone that needs help in this area should go to, Highlight Help and click on Help with Abusive Courts, okay? Read through this page thoroughly. We have updated it a little bit, but pretty much a lot the same. But then there are download intake forms, one for mortgage foreclosures and one for all the other court problems. And so if you click on the forms, if you have a habeas corpus going through the process and it hasn't gotten in, we haven't processed it yet, go refill out another form. Take the information off your old form and put it on a new form and send it to intake at nationallibertyalliance.org, and also send us another copy of your affidavit, which both of them you should have. Anyway, we do ask for a donation of $75 or more. And also, if you don't have $75 or less, it doesn't matter. I mean, if you got $25 or $5, anything to help. But even if you don't have anything, we're not charging for this. But we do need to cover the cost. It gets quite expensive with all the certified mail and all of the printing we do. Each case requires about 10 or more people to be notified, and some of them certified. And this goes through a series of filings. So this is done about three times or four times in each case. Okay, so it's quite a bit of mailing, quite a bit of printing, quite a bit of mailing cost and certified cost, and we have to cover it some way. But we don't require people to pay. So, but we do ask for the donations. For those who have sent out for the mortgages, again, if you want to finish the process, get your affidavit. If you're not sure what exactly is necessary, let me just give you a quick rundown. Once the paperwork is filed and given to you, get a copy. Within 1 week, you give it a week, then you give a call to the sheriff and ask him if he's going to protect you from these people. And because they're trying to take your property away without due process. And if the sheriff doesn't understand or doesn't want to understand or doesn't care or whatever the case may be, he's not going to help you, then you have to do an affidavit concerning that, get it to us, and then we send out the second part, okay? And the whole process or the whole design of this thing is really to put the sheriff and the judge under pressure to force them to do the right thing. Not that it's going to happen, but we've had some successes. You know, on habeas corpuses, we've had three successes. That's not a lot when you consider we have 28, but on the other hand, it's pretty darn good. It's people can get success from this. And some of these people still might get out, you know, under the pressure because we keep putting this in. And we know that they're reporting to others, and there's a lot of stress on the federal level concerning the things that National Liberty Alliance is doing. They all know us, and they're very concerned about us. And so the pressure is on, and that's the key. You know, they put up a wall of resistance, and we need to put the pressure upon that wall of resistance in order to take it down. And we, the people, need to get into our courts and take back control. So anyway. We have had successes, and I think they'll become more and more. And clearly, when we do get into the courts, anybody who has filed these papers will be able to then put that pressure very quickly and require. Once we, the people, get in charge and get into the system, we will require the release of those people immediately. And they will be released at that point in time for sure. Let's see what else we've got to cover before we move on. All right, so anyway, anybody who can help us with some monies, we really do need it. We hate to keep asking for money. I know we've been sending out a lot of letters and stuff, you know, emails asking, but the key thing is $5 or more a month. If everyone was doing that, we'd have plenty of money to do everything and anything we wanted to do, and we would do a lot more in the way of mailing, physical mailing. I'd love to do another sheriff's mailing again, but the last one we did, goodness, I think it cost $6,000-$7,000. It was a lot of money. I don't remember exactly, but it was thousands. I think it was $6,000, maybe more. And so it was quite expensive, and I'd like to do it again, but without that kind of money, we can't. But with the membership we have at $5 a head would be huge amounts of money. We'd be able to do a mailing like that occasionally, you know. So that's what we want to do. We want to get as much pressure on the courts through physical paperwork as possible. Well, we are doing the faxes, so we get a lot of the information to the courts through faxes also. All right. I don't know. Gary, do we have any questions? Is Gary here?
Yes. Yeah, we have one question.
Okay.
And it's I don't necessarily understand it, so I'm going to hope you do. This is addressed to, you know, John, Gerard, and Brent. The courts have court rules. Does Brent, John, and everyone support the claim that the rules of the courts are the common law because statutes and constitutional provisions are not common law? Do rules of the court embody the common law as we know it?
Yeah, I think we addressed this before, but you know, the court has rules, and I haven't found any problems with their rules per se, and it makes sense. They want to do things orderly and keep things in with rules and keep things moving, and there's processes of court, and you know, that's all fine. Nothing wrong with any of those things. But ultimately, there's no requirement if you don't understand or know those rules that anything that they can, you know, resist your paperwork from going through or anything of that nature. These magistrates who are judging or supposed to be really taking the process through the court, in some case they do judgments, and but generally speaking, in a common law court, when there's a jury, the jury makes the decision. But then there's equity court, and of course the judge gets the decision making at that time, and he should be working under American jurisprudence. But it is absolutely clear, and also in common law and logic and common sense, and it should be, and it's understood in the courts, or it should be if it isn't, that you don't need to be educated in anything particular to walk into a court and represent yourself. After all, the court case is all about the facts. That's what it's about. It's not about ultimately the law per se. It's about the facts. It's about injury. It's about an individual who has been injured in a certain way and is looking for a remedy. It could be an injury through a contract. It could be an injury from someone who just did something evil to someone else, and they're looking for restitution. And the only thing required for a prima facie case in the court is an affidavit. And you can scratch that with a lead pencil on a piece of paper and hand it in, and it's as good as anything else. You don't need to really have any. They do index numbers where they have the paperwork that you have to fill out. They give you an index number. Nothing wrong with filling out the paperwork. It's basic information. It's good for the files, of course. Nothing wrong with that. And anybody can fill out that paperwork. And if you can't, you ask the clerk the questions. They'll help you. The problem with it is then they ask for money. And that's when it gets dirty, and that should not be. So that part, of course, shouldn't be there. So those are the papers, you know, and then the RJI, which is a request for judicial intervention, okay, is a second paper that you'd have to also file. Again, very simple paper. You know, it's just a form. They ask you a few questions, and you write the answers down. And if you have any troubles, you ask the clerk, and they'll assist you. In the beginning, when I started doing this, I never had a problem filling those two papers out. They were very simple, and the clerks were very nice and answered my questions, and I filled them out. So it was a pretty simple process. So filling those two forms out and coming in with your affidavit is all that is required to make a case prima facie, and it should go forward. So if you go through the process and you don't know the rules of the court, the judge is required to help you along as you go. And it's that simple. And again, nothing wrong with rules. We have rules all over the place. You have rules in your own household. We have rules. We drive up and down streets. We have one-way streets. We have two-way streets. We have stop signs, you know. The rules are there to make things flow, make things go easy, and also to protect us often. So, yeah, nothing wrong with it. I don't know if Brent or Gerard wants to pipe in on that, too. Go right ahead if you want. Okay, I guess
all right,
not.
Another one, actually, two slid in under the wire.
Under the wire.
Yeah, for real. Okay, this next one is, please tell me how is it that there are no statutes in common law when the common law remedy is an administrative one as well?
Well, look, there are statutes in common law, so to speak, in the sense that we have a constitution. Okay, we have a Republican form of government. We have a constitution. And in that constitution, we have given the legislators, I think it's 19 powers or 18 powers. I have to go peek in my book to make sure on that. But I think it's 19 powers, I think. But in any event, we've given them those 19 powers to make law. And we've also given them powers to make law concerning, you know, things between other nations. Okay, treaties, shall I say. Okay, so those are statutes, and they're lawful as long as they stay within the criteria of that which we ordained and established for them. So it's very, very specific, okay? And let me see if I can't give a couple of examples on that, if I can find this pretty quick. Okay, Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and exercise. This is Section 8, Article 1, Section 8. Duties imposed to exercise to pay debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties imposed to exercise shall be uniform throughout the United States. They have the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, to regulate commerce, to establish uniform rules for naturalization, to coin money, regulate the value, to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting, to establish post offices and roads, to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. I'm going to start skipping some of these things, to declare war, grant letters of marque, raise and support armies, to provide and maintain a navy, make rules for the governing and regulation of the land and naval forces, and so on. And now on the end of this, it says to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for the carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested in this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. So in order for them to control all these powers, all these things we've given them the ability to work with and to legislate for, they obviously have to make laws. And they also have to make laws governing themselves. I mean, look, we have some good laws, U.S. 18 and U.S. 42. I forget the numbers where it talks about different things, which if they violate certain things, there are certain violations that, you know, certain punishments that are going to be applied upon them. Some things they make it very clear. For instance, if a clerk does not file, fails to file, refuses to file, that is a crime. And that's a crime because it's written down. That it is a crime here that they have to file these things. And if they refuse to file, the law that they've given the power to do, to control themselves, to control the process, their daily process, the clerk refuses to file, that clerk, I think, is up to 2 years, 1 or 2 years in prison for failing to file. And so that's an incentive for them to file. So these are all good laws. But anything, any law that Congress tries to make to control the behavior of we the people, you know, we're the kings, we are the masters, they're the servants. They cannot make any law to control our behavior. Our behavior is between ourselves and God. We have to control our own behavior. And when we do something that's outside of good behavior, that would be bad behavior, and injure another person, Now there's restitution being required. Now common law kicks into play, and the people will decide what needs to be done to restore that individual. And jail is not the answer. Restitution is the answer. Of course, jail may be the answer for certain things, and we can talk about that as we go forward, but generally speaking, and also, there should be no other jail than the county jail. There's no reason for state prisons. That's where they make all this money. There's a lot of private prisons going on there, and federal prisons and all these things. If an individual did have to be in prison for one reason or another, and I can think of some things that would require that, they should be close to home. They should be in their own counties. Every county may not have a jail, but they should. You know, there are certain counties that have very few people in it, and they may not have a jail. But I would imagine they probably do, even if it's a small one. But if not, the county next door can provide the necessary facilities for them, or however that is worked right now. But certainly, people should not be shipped away to a prison far, far away, so to speak. You know, that's a violation of the family of this person to begin with, you know. But in any event, I forget, what was the question? How did that begin again so I can get to the end of this conclusion? What was that question again, Gary?
It was, please tell me, how is it?
Oh, yeah, the laws.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so basically, yeah, there are good laws. Nothing wrong with laws as long as they don't try to control our behavior. That's the key.
And that they be in harmony with common law.
Well, absolutely. You know, there are common law documents. Clearly, the Declaration, the Magna Carta is a common law document. The Declaration of Independence is a common law document. The United States Constitution, the Constitution for the United States of America, that's a common law document. The Bill of Rights, it's a common law document. And it's written there. Ultimately, these things are written to control government. It's always written to control government. We, the people, are writing the laws, and we're creating constitutions to control the government. We, the people, ordained and established this constitution for the United States of America. And each one of the, you know, everything that this ultimately is controlling is covered in the preamble to the to the Constitution. And let me read that. We, the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union, okay, that's number one, establish justice, that's number two, ensure domestic tranquility, that's number three, provide for the common defense, that's number four, promote for the general welfare, five, and secure the blessings of liberties to ourselves and our posterity, that's six. We do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. That is the purpose of government. That is the purpose of our Constitution, to define those things. And everything they do should be serving one or more of those items. You know, whatever it is they do, they create law, they make controls, they control commerce. You know, there's commercial commerce. They have to control that. There has to be certain laws. There should be laws against monopolies, which there are, but they're not adhered to. And those are all good laws. We use common sense, and it's the laws that we've ordained by giving them the authority, and we define how far they, you know, what it is that they're writing laws for. All right, other questions?
This next one you're really going to like.
Uh-oh.
I'm just hoping you don't go all night.
Okay.
But this is interesting. I mean, I'm not being sarcastic here. It's from one of our premier members. And with the reading of the PDF that you just read tonight about the 4th of July, are you aware that today is the 23rd day of the third lunar month? I just Skyped you some texts of some scriptures that you may find worth looking at. They're in your Skype, John.
Oh, okay. Let me go take a look.
And it might be worth reading. I mean, if you did this by accident, your timing seems auspicious. Or should I say, if it's purely coincidental, it appears auspicious.
Yeah, there's quite a bit here. I will have to read this when I'm off the mic, and maybe I'll come back on and comment on this. But there's quite a bit. I don't want to hold up everybody. And I have to, you know, take a look at this and meditate on it a little bit and see once what I might be able to think about it and see if I can respond, okay?
All right, so, that's fair.
But my decision the decision to write this paper, okay, actually came out of nowhere. It came up this morning, and we had been writing information concerning the 41st Congress, which was in 1871. Which did bring forward the Organic Act of 1871. And so we had written a paragraph or two on that. And just this morning, I was looking at that and reviewing it and seeing how I can add and move things around and make it clearer and stronger and so on. And then it dawned on me, wait a second, we need to declare a declaration of our... to reiterate our Declaration of Independence from 1776. And this next week, next Monday, is the 4th of July. And I was actually going to wait until next Monday to do this and send it out. But then I said to myself, no, we need to really pump this up and push it out to get people so on the 4th of July they'll be thinking about this with as many people as we can. And to realize that we need to bring these people back into the box that we created for them.
No, John, there was a reason why you did this tonight.
Okay.
No, and well, this is pretty good.
I'll read that and I'll tell you what I think.
The stars and the moon. I mean, John, you've been mooned. So here you go.
All right, we'll see. Well, I do believe God's in charge, so who knows,
I do, and I think you're going to especially like Esther 8:9. So, because Esther is a commonly misunderstood book.
Right. I will take
incredible.
A look.
Yeah, in the time. That's it.
Right, I will try to comment on that later. So before the night is out, I'll see if I can comment on it. So,
okay, that's no more questions.
I'll pray for wisdom to be able to do so. There's another question?
I don't think you're going to need much wisdom, John. It's fairly cut and dry. But but there are no more questions.
No more questions. Okay. All right, that brings us to let me see if there's anything else. Gerard, do you have anything to announce or anything before we bring Brent in?
No, go ahead. Let Brent go on. We'll go from there.
Okay. All right. Okay. Brent Winters is going to take the mic now. Now, Brent is the author of Excellence of the Common Law, and you can get information about Brent at commonlawyer.com. That's commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk about the militia clauses of our Constitution again this evening, and we're going to progress from where we left off. We left off having discussed the first three militia clauses. We're in the fourth one, but just by way of review, rather quickly, I'll go through the four militia clauses and encapsulate what they are so we won't lose any continuity. And if you remind me at the end, John, I figured I'd wait till it was my time to talk, and I would respond to that question about common law and process in the courts. But the first militia clause concerns... Pardon?
I'm sorry, I said okay. Sounds
good. Good, thanks. The first militia clause concerns the Congress of the United States. The second militia clause concerns the states, namely the governors and the state legislature. The third militia clause concerns the duties of the presidents of the United States under the under our Constitution concerning the militia, and the fourth militia clause is the well-recognized and well-publicized and well-known Second Amendment to our United States Constitution. The first militia clause says the Congress shall have power to provide for calling forth a militia, to execute the laws of the Union, number one, number two, to suppress insurrections, number three, to repel invasions, to provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining of the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. That's Congress. You see, Congress has the power to set the standard for calling forth a militia when the president or a governor calls forth the militia of his state. Power has the Congress to set forth the standard only for the president, not for the governor. That's the state legislature's job. But has the power to set forth a standard for calling it forth to do these three things, and no other. Execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, repel invasions. And also to provide a law to govern the militia when called into actual service of the United States. That's Article 1, Section 8, clauses 15 and part of 16. First militia clause concerns Congress. Second militia clause concerning the states, and it says this, that a constitution reserves to the states, respectively, the appointment of officers, that it means officers of the militia of that state, and the authority, that means the jurisdiction, the right, of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. You see, Congress prescribes the discipline but has no power to put it into practice. The states, respectively, has the power, each of the states, for the militia within their state to appoint officers and to put into practice the training that Congress has prescribed. You see how this goes together? The third militia clause concerns presidents of the United States, that class of men, and it says this, that the president, I'm quoting our U.S. Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, the president shall be commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states, watch the proviso, when called into actual service of the United States, and the president has no power over the militia of the several states or any part of them until they are mustered at his calling. Mustered is the point. He can call them, but he has no power over them, no power to order them, no authority until they're actually mustered. Either all of the militia of the several states or any part thereof or any part of the militia of any individual state. So the first militia clause concerns Congress. The second militia clause concerns the states. The third militia clause concerns that class of persons called presidents. And the fourth militia clause, and that's where we're going to camp for a little bit tonight, the fourth militia clause says this, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And we left off last time discussing that second militia clause, and we said that our founders, we ended saying this, our founders wanted Americans to be smartly armed, ready to stop the oppressor, whether within or without. Allow me to repeat that. Our Constitution, this is what those that ratified our Constitution said. They were the speakers. They are the speakers presently. Our Constitution speaks now. Wanted Americans to be smartly armed, ready to stop the oppressor, whether within or without. And one quote from Thomas Jefferson, I think I might have said this last time, but it's a good bit of quote to quote again, said this, Tom Jefferson said, a strong body makes a strong mind. As to the species of exercises, I advise the gun. Well, this gives moderate exercise to the body. It gives boldness, enterprise, and independence to the mind. Games played with the ball are too violent for the body and stamp no character upon the mind. Let your gun, therefore, be your constant companion on your walks. And Tom Jefferson walked every evening. So I have to conclude from this statement, he probably carried a gun. He liked to walk and chew tobacco. And those that know him said that his white shirts were badly stained in the front. He apparently wasn't too good at spitting, to use the old word. We got to the word regulated, well-regulated in the Second Amendment. Well-regulated, it says a well-regulated militia. It assumes a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. That being true, says our Second Amendment, the right, the jurisdiction, the authority, the duty of the people to keep and carry a gun shall not be infringed. I know that's not an exact quote, but that is what it means. The Second Amendment's words, well-regulated militia, denote those able-bodied men of the people, who each keeps a loaded firearm in his home and carries it outside his home. And the words of the Second Amendment, free state, refer to each of the separate United States. There's a difference between a free state and a state. And there are many states around the world. What does state mean? Well, it's an old Latin root. It means the status, the way things are. It's short, for status quo. What is the state? It's pretty much status quo. There's nothing progressive about government. It's the status of it that we have. It is the people that are progressive, intelligent, creative, and productive, not the state. The state will never be creative and productive, never has been creative and productive, and wise men know that the state's duty is not to be creative and productive because it's a not-for-profit organization. I used to listen to Newt Gingrich talk about how the state ought to be run like a business. I hear other politicians talk about it. They're hucksters. They're liars. And if they don't know better, they ought to. Governments are never made, never expected. Only a bozo and a brainless fellow would think that the state was to be productive. No, that's not the job of the state. The state is inherently wasteful and non-productive. Always has been, always will be, but it is necessary, a necessary evil. But it's good for a couple of things. What are they? Well, we find those two things in our oath, and those two things for which it is good are the two duties of those able-bodied men, the people, able-bodied carrying arms. And that is found in our oath when people take office in the United States to defend our Constitution against all enemies foreign. That means the courts, to serve on the jury and to sue out the rights of your own when they're being violated, to help another, if necessary, sue theirs out. That is our rights domestic and enemies foreign. That means you're willing to take up arms and defend your land. Enemies domestic and enemies foreign, and those friends, neighbors, and kin are the two duties of government, to provide justice by providing courts and to defend our borders, national defense. Other than that, government really doesn't have much delegation from God. Matter of fact, it has none. And all of these things we see government doing are beyond the duties of the militiaman. The militiaman defines the duties of government. And the militiaman is there to pick up quite a bit of the slack, by the way, to man the juries, to sue in court when it's necessary, to defend in court when it's necessary. That's justice. And to take up arms in defense of the land. That's enemies foreign, domestic and foreign. Those are the two duties of government. And a free state confines governments to those two duties. And where government is given jurisdiction beyond those two, our Constitution doesn't really give government jurisdiction beyond those two, then the state becomes less than free to the degree that government is given more power than God has delegated and authorized for it. So we're talking about a free state here in this fourth militia clause concerning, or called the Second Amendment. Free state, those words in our Second Amendment refer to each of the separate states of the United States, the states united, confirming each state's concurrent jurisdiction over its militia with the president's concurrent jurisdiction. You see, the president, that class of men called the president, has the authority under the terms of our Constitution to call out the militia of the several states or any part thereof, any militia of any individual state or maybe just a few states depending upon the threat. But it's limited to three reasons: to repel invasions, to execute the laws of the United States, and to put down, quell insurrections. Those three reasons and no others. And Congress has given the authority to define how the president is to recognize when those three things have happened. That what is the threshold for when an insurrection occurs? Well, Congress, the Constitution says, has the power to define that. Have they done it? No, they haven't. Not, again, for at least 175 years. They've ignored their duty. That doesn't mean you can ignore yours and get away with it, because every man will answer to God direct for whether or not he fulfilled his duty. And we're talking here about the duty of the militia of the several states. And remember, I say this for emphasis, the first three militia clauses delegate authority and power. But the fourth militia clause delegates nothing. because the right of the people to keep and bear arms, the right of self-preservation, the right of self-protection of one's self, of one's family, of one's neighbors, of one's land, is delegated to the individual man from God direct, no intermediary, no redelegation. And because that's true, the Second Amendment grants nothing. All the indications of our Constitution are those that drafted its words understood those fundamental things, the difference between fundamental rights, God-given, direct, immediately from God to the individual, and those other things that we enjoy that maybe may have been delegated through another person. There's a difference. One's called the fundamental right, and the other one isn't. The fundamental rights are beyond the reach, says our Supreme Court, beyond the reach of government. In colonial days, the word regulate, found in our Second Amendment, signifies that which was kept regular. That is, that which is always in readiness, always good to go. Accordingly, in using the word regulated respecting the militia, the Second Amendment denotes those of the people always armed in every way necessary and to meet the exigencies of the time, always armed and ever ready to muster when called by the local governor or national president to execute the laws of the Union, the president, to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Now, the governor of a particular state may have other reasons to call out the militia for other duties within the state, and the state legislature will define what those are. But as to the President of the United States, the Constitution defines the only times he can call out any part of the militia of the several states. And these three reasons are the limitation. Indeed, regularity still means to remain in steady operation day in and day out. A well-regulated militia is a militia that's like the Minutemen. They were always ready. Regulated. Regular. For example, our United States Navy distinguishes between the regular Navy and the non-regular Navy, called the reserves, and every sailor knows the difference. And those that are active duty, they, with pride, call themselves the regular Navy. And the regular Navy is always at sea, always loaded down with ammunition, always loaded for bear, always in readiness for war, to strike quickly at any time. That's the regular Navy. And that's what our Second Amendment says the militia must be in order to have freedom and security at the same time. Government will promise security if you give up your freedom, and they'll give you neither. Experience teaches that. All experience in history teaches that. The only way to have security and freedom at the same time, and that's what our Second Amendment says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security, their security, of a free state, not a state, a free state, security and freedom at the same time. That being the only way to get security and freedom at the same time, our Second Amendment says, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. That's the law. That's the law of the land. Article 6 of our Constitution says it's the supreme law of the land. That's the supreme course of process, the supreme way of doing things. And that brings me to the point that was asked a while ago, and I wanted to say something I thought would be best, and John could have his time, and when I had time to talk, I could say a couple of things. But people ask questions constantly. I'm in New England right now. I'd never been here, but just one other time briefly, and I was able to speak to some people about the militia clauses. And the question constantly comes up, what is the common law? Lawyers get it wrong. The state of Utah recently got it wrong. The Supreme Court has got it wrong. And somebody says, well, Brent, are you smarter than all these people? No, I'm not smarter than all of them. They know a lot of things I don't know. But on this particular point, I say I know the answer. And I notice that other people, for whatever reason, may know something I don't know, but they don't know that. And there may be some, but I'm not finding them very often. The question continually comes up, and I'm trying to find a way to say it so it makes more sense, and I repeat what other men smarter than me have said. There are other men that have said this, and I think they're right after being involved in the legal world for a while, a few decades. Our common law is not a list of laws. It is not a set of court regulations. It's not even a set of court opinions. All of those things are a part of what our common law tradition is, but they are not our common law. Our common law is, and I say this with great emphasis, don't miss it. If you don't get anything else tonight, get this. Our common law is due process. Due process. Well, you say, what's due process? I'll tell you what it is. It's the process that is due and owing to all concerned. The process that men must make due and owing before God to all concerned. Well, what are some of the things that are part of process? Well, trial by jury in a criminal case is the way, W-A-Y, the process. You see the way things are to be done? Trial by jury, a real jury. A jury has defined, our Constitution defines a common law jury pretty well, in brief. But there are a lot of things our Constitution doesn't say because our Constitution is brief. It doesn't say everything. It doesn't say everything, but it does freight in with the words it says a lot of things that aren't said. And the people at that time understood, you didn't have to explain to them, the Constitution says the right to trial and jury, the right to trial by jury in a criminal case is guaranteed. That's all it says. Doesn't define it. Didn't have to. Because our common law informs our Constitution, and that's a lot of information, right to trial by jury. It says what a dollar is, too. Doesn't say much more about it. Freights in a lot of information without saying it that people understood at that time. When it says the supreme law of the land, Article 6, that phrase law of the land lifted from Magna Carta means, and meant at that time of Magna Carta, it just meant one thing. Due process. They didn't call it due process. They called it process at that time. They call it the law of the land. What is due process? Again, it is the process, the course, the way things are to be done, not what is to be done. That's, yes, it is what is to be done, but that's not the stress of that phrase, due process. That's not the stress of the words, common law. That's not the stress of the law of the land, that phrase. All three of those mean the same thing. Our common law has been called many things down through the centuries, but law of the land is one of them. And our common law is not, due process is not a part of our common law. Due process is our common law. And the interesting thing, the fascinating thing, the curious thing about due process, which is our common law, is that due process cannot be known in any particular instance until there's a real case in controversy. Our common law is different than all of the rest of the world. You've got to have a genuine fight. You've got to have a bloody plaintiff. You've got to have people that got a dog in the fight. They've got a stake in the outcome, and they're willing to pour their hearts and their blood and their minds and their souls into the fight. And if the case isn't ripe enough, if there isn't a bloody plaintiff, our Constitution says that there isn't a, watch these words, real case and controversy. Oh, there's nothing scholastic about our common law. There's nothing speculative. Speculation doesn't even enter into it. Listen, if you can't go into court and say, I've been injured to the tune of, I don't even know what it is anymore. It used to be $10,000, then it went to $50,000, then it went to $100,000. Then federal court, you've got to claim well over $100,000 injury just to get into court. You've got to be real bloody. And you better be able to prove something up or you've lied to the court. So our common law is process. It's a fair fight. It's a fight, F-I-G-H-T. That means there's got to be some scratching, some biting, and some hitting. There has to be hard blows, as the Supreme Court says. Hard blows, but never foul ones are allowed. No, the Supreme Court said foul blows are not allowed. You got to fight, but you got to fight according to the rules. What are the rules? Here they are, due process. What is fair? Due process, we could define it by, what is a fair fight? I'm reminded of that old John Wayne movie. And it was, I think it was McClintock. And they got into a fight. There was a big brawl, usually is in some of those old westerns. There was a big brawl beside this mining claim, and they were having a terrible time in the mud. And one fella got in a fight with another, and he got the tar beat out of him. And he said to John Wayne after it was over, he said, you know, he fought me a fair fight. He fought me a fair fight. Well, that's an old common law doctrine. And it's only known in common law countries. Another phrase that's arisen out of the common law that's become part of our culture, that was more of an Americanism. He fought me a fair fight. I even heard that when I was growing up. But in England, they said, fair play, fair play. If it ain't fair play, I'm not going to trust the result. I'm not going to fight except according to the Queensbury rules. And that's what we fight boxing matches, according to the rules. They can be tough, but there are rules. That's what due process it is. It's fighting according to the rules. And the rules are the due process. So when you talk about the rules of the court, are they common law? Well, they may be or they may not. You see, the common law is eternal. As Justice James Wilson says, it's the truth of the way things ought to be and the nature of things. But our common law is that first volume of the laws of nature, called the laws of nature. Our Declaration of 76 says there are two volumes of law upon which our country is founded. The laws of nature, that's the first volume. It's unwritten in the nature of things in creation. That's due process. That's our common law. It's unwritten. That means we have to observe it. Sometimes we write our observations down. For example, Magna Carta, our Constitution, our agreements upon what is right and what is wrong, respecting the way things ought to be done, the way, W-A-Y, the course that ought to be followed. But that course is a fair fight. Our common law rules rose out of the world of chivalry. And in chivalry, and if you got mad at somebody, your honor is offended, you want to challenge somebody to a duel. You weren't allowed to do it yourself. So in common law, if you sue somebody, you're not allowed to serve them yourself. You've got to get somebody else to do it for you. That's the rules of chivalry that arose in those days. So you have somebody else, could be the sheriff, could be his deputy, could be a U.S. Marshal, serves the process. That's an old chivalrous concept, is serving a process. Notice of the time and place of the bout, of the fight. If the other fellow doesn't get process, doesn't get that notice, and you show up and he doesn't show up, that's not fair. So the result is unfair. It wasn't a fair fight. He defaulted. He didn't even know about it. You say he defaulted. No. You got to notice him up, as we say in our common law world. Give him notice of the time and the place of the contest. That's called notice and an opportunity to be heard. We don't hurl weapons anymore. Battle. It's not trial by battle in America or in England or in Canada or in Australia. It's not trial by battle. It's battle by trial. We used to hurl weapons. Now we hurl oaths, O-A-T-H-S, and testimonies, evidence. We hurl evidence. We array it before the jury. They are the witnesses to the evidence, and then they decide. So people struggled for centuries to define the common law, and I've read all sorts of definitions. I kind of like to read William Fratcher because used to know the old fella, and he used to put, old when he died, I guess he wasn't so old all that time, but he wrote articles about what is the common law and the Encyclopedia of Law, and he wrote law review articles, and he tried to describe what people say the common law is. Some people say the common law is not statute law. Well, that's fundamentally true. That still doesn't define what the common law is, because ultimately the common law is never known. Remember, the common law is due process. It's a fair fight. It's the rules that require such a fight. The rules of evidence, the rules of litigation. And that process can't be known until there's a real case and controversy, a real fight, a real down and dirty contest. I say down and dirty, yeah, you have to roll around in the mud to fight sometimes, but you still have to fight according to the rules. And whether or not any particular court has recognized and written down the rules that are true and right according to the standards of God, well, that's a question for you. That's a question for me. And if they've done wrong, then we put things in process to get rid of people like that. And if they persist upon not observing due process, then in the past we've impeached them. We asked our legislator to impeach them. I read stories of men that wanted to impeach judges and ran for the state legislature for that very reason and got the job done, or ran for the U.S. Congress and pushed impeachment proceedings through. That's the way it's supposed to work. If Congress won't do it, you've got the option of running and entering the contest yourself and getting in that other branch of government and doing that. Well, that's just a comment on that, but it's a long footnote. The phrase well-regulated in the Second Amendment denotes the always well-armed and ready-to-fight people. In a word, a well-regulated militia is, I say is, that's proper, those individuals of the able-bodied people that keep at least one loaded firearm in their homes and carry that firearm whenever such a man is outside the home. The word militia, in its general sense, when standing alone, refers to the non-military yet able-bodied population, that is, the people. Thus have writers always used the term. Further, the framers of our Constitution understood this militia, which is the people, in two parts. Now watch me close on this. I use these words myself. I don't know anybody else that uses them, but I was searching for a way to describe this. The militia always exists. It is the people, armed or unarmed. That's what the word militia is, and that's not. There's no debate on that point. But there are two parts. It comes in two standings, two postures. The non-regular militia is that part of the people. The people is the militia. That part of the people able to arm themselves and ready to fight at a moment's notice, but have not done so. They have not armed themselves, are not ready to fight. They're still the militia. But by contrast, the regular militia, the well-regulated militia, is that part of the people always well-armed, always prepared, always ever ready and willing to train or fight upon being called out. That is, upon a moment's notice. Thus did the Massachusetts militia that responded to resist the Redcoats at Concord and Lexington call themselves the Minute Men, in distinction from the non-regular militia. That's enough for this evening. We can continue next time if I have the opportunity. I like to say, Lord willing, I will continue next time. And if John wants to take time for questions, I'm willing to do that, as I did last week and the week before.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Yeah, we'll take some questions in a minute. You mentioned that you wanted to comment a little bit on, goodness, I wrote a note on that. What was it, the rules of the court?
Well, and I appreciate you bringing that up, but I saw an opportunity in the middle, and I said what I think I need to say about what the common law is and the rules of the court. The rules of court are men's recognition in the nature of things, what they believe is right, to ensure a fair fight in court. That's what the rules of the court are. And if they're wrong, and they could be, because our common law is not, our common law is the laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of things, that we are to observe ourselves and write down when necessary. Whereas the laws of nature's God are written down, in particular in the Bible, as Blackstone tells us. So what is observed in our common law, and our common law says this too, by the way, it says that any part of what is decreed or declared, I should say, said to be our common law, that is in consonant with the laws of nature's God, the Bible, is not our common law. That's been the traditional understanding of our common law for centuries. And it remains so whether people acknowledge it or whether they say so. So it is the rules of the court are the rules that ensure a fair fight as men understand them, whoever is responsible to define those rules. And if they're wrong, then they need to be changed. But our common law is always there. It's always true. It has existed since the beginning of time. It's as old as the lawgiver himself. But because God himself has not seen and superintended its writing down, it's up to men to do it, and sometimes they make mistakes. And that's why the legislature of each state, and every legislature, every person elected to office, every person in office, whether a judge, an officer of the court, a legislator, a president, a governor, a bureaucrat, every person, and this is the genius of our common law tradition, is responsible to recognize what the common law is, what is right and wrong in a given situation, and ensure it's done that way. Even our legislation, people say our common law is not statutes. Well, that's not necessarily always true. It depends. Every person in government has a right, has a duty to do right, and no man in government or out ever has a right to do wrong. So when the legislature acts, they have a duty to act right. They have a duty to act according to the common law, and as we said before, even the Habeas Corpus Act, put in place a way to ensure, to better ensure than they had before, that people would not be falsely imprisoned in England. And we have adopted that act passed by Parliament. That was Parliament observing in the nature of things a way, a process whereby where we could readily and quickly end false imprisonment. That's been a pretty good idea, and the legislature did that, by the way. But where the legislature is wrong, it needs to be corrected when they're against right process and good process.
Okay, thank you. All right, we'll open up for questions. So if anybody has any questions, let me change modes here, go over to Q&A. All right, if anybody has any questions or comments for Brent, star 6 to get into the queue. And so star 6 should put you into the queue. I think you have to hit star 6 or you have to hit some other number, but it should tell you that. Just real quick, I know you mentioned a couple of times, Brent, that concerning the habeas corpus, that it is something that is written, which is true. And as a matter of fact, habeas corpus is written in our Constitution. And I know here in New York, it's also written in the Constitution here in New York. Habeas corpus is the right of due process. So ultimately, that in itself is the common law that actually is written into a code. And I don't think we would be looking at it from the other side, that the code was written first and it works out well in common law. I think that you would agree with that, that it's a common law principle written into a code, finally, at some point in time.
The Parliament recognized it. They said this is what it needs to be. This is the process that men need to follow to quickly remedy the problem of false imprisonment. And it's worked better than the process that they had tried before, which wasn't all bad, but it just wasn't as efficient. It didn't give the handle that habeas corpus has been able to give. And, of course, now, by bureaucratic decree, it's being whittled away badly.
Yeah, these past years, and I don't know how long it's been, you know, I can only know from the time that I became conscious of these things, that it seems that the right of due process has been just about all but gone, and habeas corpus is totally ignored and rejected and denied every single time before every single judge that I've heard of. I mean, I'm sure somewhere some habeas corpuses might come through. We've gotten 3 through ourselves. Out of 28,
that's not a very good drag. That speaks loudly. It's a sad commentary on what's going on. But for example, Congress, not many years ago, passed a statute that has whittled habeas corpus down to a nubbin. Well, that's Congress doing the wrong thing. That's a legislature doing the wrong thing, not following common law process, limiting habeas corpus to a year, for example, after incarceration, after imprisonment or something. The Constitution doesn't say that, or common law never said that. Parliament over in England never said that, and that's our tradition coming up to us. Now, if we can come up with a better way, W-A-Y, a better procedure to ensure that people are given quick remedy for false imprisonment, we should be all for it. And maybe there is a better way, but so far we haven't come up with one. But that is something that should be considered, maybe, if something could come up, if somebody could come up with a way that was better. But our common law, I say it again, is process, and habeas corpus is a good example, because habeas corpus is a distinct, quick, hard-hitting process that demands certain things, and it's something that everybody that's falsely imprisoned can do and should be allowed to do.
One of the things that we are working on, as I'm sure you know, is building the administrations, which are the people themselves, four in every county, in order to administer to the juries, then both the grand jury and the trial juries, for the purpose of really bringing them up and to getting ready for the work ahead of them as a jury or a trial jury or a grand jury. But one of the processes, or one of the things that really would be available to the people, is if the people were in a court or felt that they were being abused by a court, they could come to the grand jury. They can come to the administrators of the grand jury and make the point that they're not getting due process. And from that perspective alone, a phone call could be made to correct that problem with that judge or whoever that is violating this person's right of due process. If that person's correct, of course, and if they wouldn't listen to them, then of course they can bring it to the grand jury, and the grand jury can tell him and require that he appreciate and submit to due process of law, that the people are required of. So that's another way in the future, Lord willing, we get there, that we can do this kind of thing and put the pressure on these people. And if the judge still refuses to the grand jury, then the grand jury has the option of indicting for bad behavior and disobedience and violating this person's unalienable rights ultimately. So it's something, another way that something could happen in the future. Lord willing, we get into power, and I do believe that we're going to get there. So,
I certainly hope that. Well, I won't comment. Go ahead.
That was it on that.
Pardon?
That was all I had to say on that. Anyway, if you want.
And I didn't have anything else to say either. I just in general agreement, and the process is the main thing, and that's what I'm trying to get across right now. Even if you have a problem in court and a judge. You know, we're very, and as Americans, and we've always been in our common law tradition generous with judges because we know that men at their best are still only men at best, and judges make mistakes and because they're men. That's why they make mistakes, are just like us. And we've given them great latitude, and they have a hard job. I wouldn't want to listen to the things that judges listen to all day long. I know they get paid, but there's still not enough money sometimes to pay a man to get him to give attention to some of the horrendous things that he must give attention to. But there is always limits. No matter how rude a judge may be, and we all tolerate that, and that's part of judge-itis, lawyers like to say, just the frustration of being in that position. But there are limits, and the law must prevail. The due process must be observed, whatever it is. And it is not always known until there's a conflict, until there's a fight. And then it becomes apparent what is fair and what isn't. That's the genius of our common law.
Well, amen. All right, well, we do have a few people in the queue, and we'll get to them in a minute. Gary, you still here? Mr. Gary. I don't know if Gary's here. Jen, do you see Gary? Is Gary still here?
No,
oh, yeah, he is still here. I see him on the, he's on the board anyway. I don't see him on the phone, though.
Sometime he leaves the board up.
Okay. All right, just a quick comment. I think what he was talking about in Esther chapter 8, verses 9 through 12, it was a situation where Mordecai, who was actually under the death penalty, a death sentence, and all the Jews in the region back in those days was sort of under a death sentence because of a decree by the king. But then things turned around, and ultimately in these verses of Esther, chapter 8, verses 9 through 12, Mordecai was given the authority by the king to write in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring, and sent letters into the king in that the king granted the people to stand for their lives. In other words, they had the authority and the right to defend themselves. And that focus in time was on the 13th of Adar, which was a Saturday. It was the 23rd of Sivan, S-I-V-I-A-N. And if they calculate that into our calendar, that's June 29th, 2016. And I'm presuming what Gary is making the point is the letter that we're sending out, which will probably go out tomorrow and the next day, will be arriving to them on June 29th. So it's kind of an interesting idea here. But later on it goes on and talks about, and this is a letter to all the rulers and the lieutenants and the deputies of the land to let them know, stand down, or we're going to defend ourselves. And so that is what I think he was referring to. There was another date here that the finale of the whole thing took place, and that was on the 13th of Adar, which actually is next year because the 12th month. Let me think about that. It would follow into the 12th month, which runs into next year because our calendar is from the Jewish calendar to our calendar is off, and that would fall on March 11th. 2017, which, you know, I don't know if that means anything to us, but it's just interesting, and I guess that's why Gary had brought that up. But anyway, let's move on. We have a couple of people into the queue. Anybody else wants to get into the queue, star 6, to ask a question or make a comment to Brent? We have first person is Jeremiah from California. You got the mic. Go right ahead, Jeremiah.
Thank you, John, for taking my call, and everyone, hello. I wish you all very well, and it's really quiet right now. Super impressed with the quiet, but the question is about to the rules of evidence. Brent mentioned common law are the rules of evidence. And he did it in an excited way, and I knew he felt what he was saying. And so I wanted to make mention of what I heard recently on another call about the small claims court and how traditionally they throw out they throw out traditional rules of evidence. Is small claims court like a place where anything kind of goes? And is that a good question?
Well, it's a good question if I know the answer, I suppose. The small claims court is a little more lax, has been my experience, with rules of evidence. And it's, of course, you're talking about small things. And as things get smaller, the rules may be lax in some places. And it is true also that rules of evidence can get pretty particular in a particular state or particular jurisdiction. And sometimes following the rules of evidence don't give you due process. Sometimes following the rules of evidence, given a certain set of facts, will violate a fair fight. There are exceptions, in other words, and as Bacon used to say, the exception to the rule in law ought to establish the rule. If the exception to the rule doesn't establish the rule, in case it's not accepted, it's wrong to follow the exception. That's a maxim of equity. But sometimes, given a set of circumstances will arise, a set of facts will arise that just don't fit anything that the rules that have been fashioned so far allow to work. So that's why due process, I said a while ago, it's true that due process isn't always even known until the real facts arise, and then due process must emerge. That's not to say anybody makes it up as they go. It should become apparent, and that's what the courts have always said. Mm-hmm. It emerges. The rule emerges. And we grab it, we see it, we recognize it, we say, okay, in cases like this, here's the way to follow due process. Here's the due process.
So you're talking precedent.
Pardon?
You said you were talking about precedent, it sounds like.
Well, when the courts make set forth their opinion concerning a certain case and a certain particular set of facts, that can be used as guidance in future cases, and often is. And the common law does that. You see, in the rest of the world, in the Roman civil law world, every country in the world almost, and even in Islam and Talmudic law, all of those, it's forbidden. It's an understood rule. You don't go back to any former judicial decisions. You never consult them. You must, in every case, repair to the code, go back to the code, go back to the statute. You can't go back to cases. And the statutes become more and more in those cases, regulations are added to fill in the gaps to where they think that they've preempted every possible future contingency. They think they've thought of every
right.
possible behavior of man that could have ever bobbed forth from the flux of human existence. Well, that's impossible. We've discovered that through the centuries. But what codes traditionally try to do, and legislatures have always tried to do for thousands of years, is to try to preempt any need for courts, to think of everything, to become so detailed that every move of man in the future is controlled by permission of the legislature. That's what legislation is all about, controlling the future. And there's some things we have to do to legislate, but it's very dangerous,
right.
Very dangerous.
May I interject here?
I think I'm done, so go ahead.
I want to compliment you on two things. What you just said, first of all, is in harmony with something I read. I'll just read it real quick. It says, by its nature, legislation is cast in general terms, that is, in broad categories, because it is law written to affect future conduct rather than law written to decide specific case. General legislative language must then be applied to individuals and to the particular controversy being litigated. Statutory language may also be vague. For example, businesses cannot act in unreasonable restraint of trade. So that was an example of a vague statute. But But anyways, my point, I guess, was to say, go ahead.
Statutory law, legislation, is always a broad brush. Another word that sometimes writers use is uniform. Everybody has to conform whether it fits or not. And all the round pegs, if you're a round peg, you still got to be pounded into that square hole and vice versa. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of legislation. It's bureaucratic law. One size fits all. Well, the genius of our common law is one size doesn't fit all. We don't have to go back to the code. And the judges in a common law country are not required to go back to the code and not look at former cases. No, we're required in America, in a common law country, to consult previous decisions. That's what we're required to do. It's called stare decisis. It's called the pole star of our common law, stare decisis. That means let the decision stand. Because previous experience, in that other case, on facts like kind of like the one we got in front of us, says this. And that's what guides our common law. And it is, but it doesn't have to be followed. It is the thread that goes through all of the cases. And you look at all the cases. That's what a good common lawyer does, a good judge. He looks at the cases on like facts, and he sees a thread going through. He tries to discern that thread. And then on his case, he tries to continue that thread. That thread, that threads of what is right and what is wrong, as according in setting forth process, the way things are done. He tries to just continue that thread, given the facts he has before him. And all the facts of every particular case, every tub must sit on its own bottom, the old common lawyers used to say. And in America, we said every skin must hang by its own tail. And in our common law courts, we say every case must rest upon its own facts, because the facts of every case are different. And in a common law country, we tailor the result. We impanel the jury. We grab 12 people standing around, and we ask them to tailor the result to the facts of this case. But as the fight's going on, as the jury is witnessing the evidence, they observe the combat. They observe the trial, the battle by trial. And they don't know all the rules. The lawyers or the litigants and the judge, they battle it out and they fight over the rules. But in the end, this is the way it's supposed to work. The jury gets to decide. That's the way it works. It's all a matter of a fair fight. Just keep that in your mind. Due process is a fair fight. It is fair play. That ain't fair, we used to say when we were kids, when we fight. There's certain things we weren't allowed to do, or and if we did, we weren't thought much of. When boys got in fights when I was growing up, kicking, biting, scratching, they weren't allowed to. We didn't have fancy rules, but I distinctly remember that if anybody did that, they weren't thought much of. There was a fair fight that was supposed to be fought. Well, that's the way it is in the courts, and that's the way it is in all of life, and that's the way God wants it and demands it to be. Okay. What's that? Go ahead.
I just want to thank you. Sorry, you know, to interrupt you at the end there, but it's thanking you because I did learn something tonight. First of all, you were reading my questions, and someone called in and read the questions. You answered them. I think John did some answering also, so I appreciate the feedback. But I'm thanking you because tonight I finally got it again. What you mentioned about the fourth militia clause, it took a while, but I finally saw what you were trying to point out about the president being able to. Well, this is my interpretation of what you said, that the president has authority according to the Constitution to call forth the militia from the several states, and you know because it's the not delineated, it's not designated, and it doesn't mention it's the people at all, that means that the right is retained by the people. There's other amendments that support, is it the 10th Amendment, or talking about enumerated rights? And so, therefore, I'm thinking that what you're saying makes total sense. It would, and the Second Amendment is there to support that 10th Amendment and the Second Amendment work together. It's really beautiful what you said earlier, so thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate your question. Just to reiterate, our Constitution is a brief of common law government. Common law government is the observations of men over centuries. And the common law government of our Constitution, puts in brief, has been hammered out over centuries, and it is a cloth, a woven cloth, warp and woof, no seams. That's our common law. And that's why when you look at the Constitution, the text, you know, we call it a text, and a text ought to be, that's a word in an old language that means to weave, text. context means to weave. The words and the phrases of our Constitution weave together very well, not because the people who drafted it were so smart, but because they were awash and swimming and inundated with the common law. As the Supreme Court Justice Taft said, they were awash in the common law. They breathed the air of the common law in America and in England. That was all they knew. And because that was all they knew, they just put it together like they understood it, and there it was. And when you look at the text, it all fits together in an intricate, beautiful pattern. This thing you were talking about, the Tenth Amendment, and also the militia, and the militia is woven throughout our Constitution, the principles thereof. And the people, it starts out with the people. That is the militia, and then it just continues from there. And the duties of the militia are just as important to serve on the jury. The jury is the big thing. You know, armed defense is important. It's good to have it. You got to have it. You know, King Alfred the Great, they call him the Great. He's the only king that those stoic, stiff upper-lipped English people ever called great, Alfred the Great. He said you got to have three kinds of men to have a successful country. You've got to have working men. You've got to have praying men, and you've got to have fighting men. You've got to have all three. And all three of those, of course, overlap quite a bit, work and prayer and work and fighting. Fighting's work, and courts are work. Speaking's work. Mm-hmm. You got to work. You got to be ready. That's what makes life rich. It's not worth living. Go ahead.
Okay, you got to keep
I've got
it
one
short
last thing.
We have other people out
okay.
there, right? So, real short.
All right, this is it. This is it. And I think it's a lovely way to cap the questions. I wanted to ask about free inhabitants. And you see, the people have the right to bear arms, right? But I noticed what they did to the American Indians, you know, the free inhabitants in there, according to the history books. What is all this sovereign citizen and making people think that they're free inhabitants about? Is that a way of stripping them of their Second Amendment right?
Well, I'm not sure. That phrase is used in different places, and the American Indian, the red man, fought in a lot of the units in the Continental Forces and in the militias of the several states during our war for separation from Britain. They were close allies. I remember reading one instance of the contest they used to have, shooting hornet's nest, the white inhabitants, the New Englanders. Where the men in their units, the red men that had arrows, they'd have contests shooting hornet's nests, and they got along quite well. So some of the stories you hear about the abuses, oh, I'm sure they were there. A lot of white men were abused in America by red men. A lot of red men were abused by white men. But the stories of their working together aren't told as much, and they ought to be, because there were a lot of friendships forged. And by the way, anybody whose family has been here more than 175 years has red blood in their veins. I read that genetic history years ago, and I know it has to be true. And what I'm saying is the white man in early America mixed with the red man and intermarried with the red man quite a bit, sometimes on the sly, sometimes secretly. But there was a lot of intercourse between them, and that should be talked about more, because we, as Americans, we don't even look like Europeans because of that. We look different. That's because we've got all that other blood mixed up in us, and we don't even know how or where, most of us. But that's another
Speak to the Second Amendment, though.
Yeah.
Well, just speak to the Second Amendment. That's what I was asking about, was the Second Amendment, and how weren't the Native Americans disarmed, and is this whole thing kind of with,
for most of
you know,
our history,
people
no,
think,
they, weren't,
yeah.
they weren't disarmed.
No,
there were,
okay.
There were specific
no, thank you.
Instances where they were, and we went to war against them. Yes. The Indian nations didn't want to be part of our country, that's clear. But that's a complex subject. It's different with every tribe. It ended all, of course, at Wounded Knee, and that was a travesty and a terrible thing
okay.
that happened, and a lesson to all of us about letting the government disarm you.
Yeah. Thanks,
okay,
John.
Thank you, Jeremiah.
Thank you, Brent.
So our next
thank
caller.
You.
Jim from Pennsylvania, you got the mic. Go right ahead. Jim?
Yeah, this is Jim. I've got a question for Mr. Winters or one of the National Liberty Alliance team. Would you be able to comment on the hearings with Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Maricopa County Arizona. Are you familiar with that? And it seems like it's not a fair fight with this case over in Arizona.
Well, he's been in so many scrapes, or what? I don't know what the latest one is. I've got my head buried in other things. What are they trying to do to him now?
Well, they're just he's saying he violated the court order, and he's doing these patrols to look for I think they're saying Latinos, and it seems like the gentleman is just trying to do his job as the sheriff, and it just seems like it's not a fair fight. They're dragging him into court, and I just thought NOA or Mr. Winters could comment on that if there's
I'd like to make a comment. I don't even know the facts of the case, but I know this. The reason we have juries is because fights often aren't fair, and we have the jury for that very reason, as Justice Scalia said, because we don't want to, without the jury, all we have standing between the accused and the government is a lone employee of the state called a judge, and he was including himself in that class of men. He said, that's not what you want. He said, we're just men. He did recognize that. I'll say that for him. And he recognized that the jury is there because we don't trust men. Our motto is in God we trust. And that's why we impanel the jury. And people say, well, the jury is made up of men. And I say, well, yeah, that's right. But God has ordained a way of doing things. And the jury, by the way, is part of that. We see it in the Bible. And it's laid out clearly. 12 apostles, there's no getting around the number 12 has to do with a lot of ruling in the Bible, and it's from beginning to end, and it has grand significance in our common law petit jury of 12. And what I'm going to look now, what they're doing to him, so many things are happening that are so crazy, so lawless, so, as you said, unfair. But keep this in mind, in politics, politics is war, and there's nothing fair in politics. Politics is evil inherently. And it's different than government, far different. Politics, and even the word citizen. We were talking a while ago about freemen. In the old common law tradition, there were no citizens. That's a civil law country. Citizen is from the root civil. It means city. It means to belong to the city religion, the law, the government, to have the protection of the metropolis, the mother city, the polis, the politics of it all. And we in America traditionally have called ourselves freemen. And freemanship is the art we were to learn. And this word citizen is the imprint of Babylon. It is the imprint of Rome. It has nothing to do with our common law. We use it. We know what we mean when we use it. It's sad that the word crept in. There are better words to use that would have the true connotation of what men are supposed to be and what God wants them to be. And I'm certain that this whole thing going on with the sheriff, I'll look into it, I'm sure it has to do with a whole lot of politics. I mean, he's in that kind of world, and when the closer you get to the top, the more political it comes, and the less chance you have of a jury getting between you and the accusers.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Appreciate the question. I'm going to kind of keep this to one question per person, and if you want to get back in line, you can try, because we want to at least get everybody to the mic that we can. Thanks, Jim. Let's go to our next caller, and I don't know who this is, but it's a 212 number. That's New York City, 9138. Give us your first name, and I guess you're from, where are you from, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens?
It would be 718 if I was from the Bronx, Brooklyn, or Queens, and it was a landline, but it's a cell number, and I'm in Rockland County.
Okay, so you're calling from where? Queens
Rockland.
Or Rockland? Rockland County. Go right ahead.
Yeah, upstate a little.
Yep,
how you guys doing? Good to hear you guys talk. Mr. Winters, is it?
Yes.
Yep, Brent Winters.
Yeah, very interesting. I just came from the federal courthouse in White Plains today. So I've been, and you talk about fair fight. I mean, that's like it makes so much sense what you're saying, like a fair fight, and. It when that's not recognized, I mean, it's literally bullying. It's like sticking somebody in the ring with like a lightweight with a heavyweight that are equally or experienced, or even the heavyweight is more experienced.
That's a good analogy. That's a good analogy. Like putting a heavyweight champion against the flyweight.
What's worse is you see, like, legislation and you see the judiciary, they're saying that we need to protect the most vulnerable people in our society. Therefore, we need to put more public defenders in play and take away the right of the people to speak. It, in the Constitution, it says we have the right to assistance from counsel. That's almost turned into shut up and do what I tell you to do. That's what I've experienced over the last 3 years in court. I've never signed a piece of paper. I've never asked for any counsel. They just tell me, you have this counsel, and now the counsel is getting in the ring and taking a dive.
Yeah.
They're taking a dive. Uh-huh. And they're getting paid. They're fueling, they're just creating revenue for the system to keep it. But it was funny. I went to the federal courthouse in White Plains today, and it was empty. It was empty. It was like nobody there. It wasn't like the county court. It was empty. And you say due process, a fair fight. And I'm hoping, because I just don't feel like I can get a fair fight where I'm at. I mean, when you, I'm looking at the findings of fact of a ruling, and
well, do you have a question for Brett?
No, yeah, I do. Is there any way to get a fair fight?
That's an excellent question. Well, it's up to us, the people, to demand a fair fight. And I've told people that have come to me for help, and because they don't get a fair fight, and they go on for years, and I've concluded in my own mind and told them that every time you go into court and you demand what's right, and the judge hears it, or the court hears it, and this applies to other situations also, anytime you do that, you're giving the opportunity to the court, to the judge, to do right. And if he doesn't, he piles up wrath against wrath for himself. And there's nothing you can do about that. But God calls men to speak the truth. And by years, I've just concluded that sometimes, maybe more often than not, I'm speaking to the cubic foot of air in front of my face. And I must get comfortable with that and do what I'm supposed to do. God says speak the truth and demand what is right. And if you don't do it, he says, when the judgment falls, it's going to fall on you too. But if you see what's going on wrong and you're willing to say so, you've done your duty. You've done your duty, and when the judgment falls, it won't fall on you. Now, the duty you're supposed to do is we, the people of the United States, is the militia. That's what our Supreme Court tells us. And our duty as members of the militia is to take the truth into court when necessary, to serve on the jury, to sue out a case if necessary, to defend domestically the rights of the land, the rights of men, and to establish dignity and honor. That's what court should be about. And if you go into court and do that, be happy that you've done your duty. If it comes time to defend against foreign enemies, that means take up arms, and I imagine you'd be willing to do that. But you're doing your duty. What we get worried about too much, and I've had to learn this over many decades, is result. The result is God's. The Bible says the judgment is his. If you follow the process, if you follow due process, if you follow the law of the land, if you do it the way he says to do it, then the judgment is his, and he'll ratify the result. But the result is not my responsibility. My responsibility, I go into court for people, I make arguments. They get upset because we don't win. But I say to them, I'm not paid to make the decision. The judge is paid to make the decision. I can't make the decision. I can't even get him to do right if he doesn't want to do it. But it is my job. In America, we have freedom of speech, and if we lose it in the courts, everything is lost. We lose it in other places. We must have the right. Pardon?
Dave, that's exactly what's happening. That's what's happened for 3 years to me in court. And
yes.
I said, look, And then I had to go home and do reading after the judge won. These judges keep removing themselves from the case.
Yes, I can imagine.
I won't submit. I can't submit to something I didn't do.
Well, no, I understand your point, and I can relate to what you're saying. But it is your duty to stay after it as long as God gives you strength to do it. And if you reach a point you can't do it anymore, you have to find some other way to deal with it. But if you're doing right, your pillow should sleep well at night, if you're saying the truth. And that's what God requires. He doesn't require us to achieve a certain result. You know, in the evil empire in the world, result is everything. The law of the city, the civil law, is result-oriented. We must achieve the will of the powerful party, and that's what we're trying to do to you, the powerful party. You're not the powerful party. The civil law says the result of the legislature must be achieved, the results of the power that be. Our common law says don't focus on the result and don't focus on achieving a result. Stick to the process, let the chips fall where they may. The result is God's. It's not yours. It's not mine. And our job is to follow right process, to insist upon a fair fight, fair play, and substantial justice. That's our job. When I believe that if men will focus upon their job, that God, in the end, will keep them safe. But it takes a whole lot of work, and it takes a lot of faith. It takes belief that doing what God tells you to do will get the best blessing for everyone. And if you have that faith, you'll obey God. That's what obedience is all about. And that's what due process is all about. And God likes due process because God likes the truth to bob forth. And the truth won't bob forth unless his process is followed. The Bible says that the truth is buried in unrighteousness, Romans chapter 1, buried. And the only way it's going to bob forth is through his processes and his ways. We call it a common law, due process, the law of the land.
Okay, thanks for your question. We're going to take the next caller. If you want to get back into the queue, you can. Okay, because we still have a couple more people.
Yeah, thanks. Here. Thanks, John.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next caller is a 541 caller. Can you give us your first name and your state?
Thank you. This is TJ calling from Oregon.
How you doing, TJ?
Doing well, thank you, John. My question is maybe just a broader, more general question. Comparison, you know, in the discussion of the common law and due process, which I really appreciate your perspective on, you know, out here a lot of people that I talk to, they're dealing with the concept of that really when they're going into court, there's a presumption that they're an enemy combatant coming in rather than a man. How does one somewhat address that issue coming into that court system? Because I think that might be sort of what our previous caller was somewhat wrestling with.
Well, good. I'm not sure. It is true that it is going into court. Litigation is battle, but it's not. A fellow won't prevail the way he probably otherwise could have if he doesn't come in and acts like it's not a battle. In other words, you don't go into court loaded for bear and biting people's heads off. The man that goes into court and actually seems a little detached and aloof from the process, but just calmly ask for the process that is due process, will fare better. And if a fellow focuses on, if the battle is a matter of consistency and focusing upon the course, staying the course, that's the battle. Not achieving victory, whatever we think victory is. You know, even in our common law courts, we don't say, well, I won or I lost. And our law recognizes, our law says you either prevail or you don't prevail. That's different. And sometimes I've come out of court and I said, I can't tell whether I won or I lost. I had to think about it a while. The judge said this, that, and the other, and pretty soon I said, wait a minute. You know, he chewed me up one side and down the other, cleaned my plow, and then he gave me what I wanted, but I couldn't tell because of the way he was talking to me. It just all depends. But in all events, you don't gain anything going into court and being openly belligerent. It won't work. And maybe that's what you're getting at.
Getting at is the concept that, you know, the 14th Amendment citizen issue, people coming in and then the courts presuming that they're a citizen, which you mentioned earlier, the problem. I'm just trying to figure out a good way to explain and how to reconcile.
Well, you did make a point that they treat you like an enemy combatant, and to some degree that's absolutely true, because I have noticed, especially before I knew much about the courts, and I would go in and try to, battle in the courts on issues, usually contract issues. But even in the beginning, when we had started doing the process in the court and trying to learn how to really go in and do this properly, we're trying to study law, and it's going back about 8 years ago. But even today, it still continues. We discover that the first order of business that I have always found every single time, with very few exceptions, is I first have to fight the judge. It's always a battle with the judge, and I think that's what everyone's really talking about, because they get involved in the case, and they don't let you get to the point where you're really dealing with the facts. They never let you get there. That's been my experience.
Well, no, I see that. I see what you're right, and that's been mine a lot of times too. So I understand what you're saying, and so you're looked at like you're the enemy because you say certain things. But if you're persistent at it, every time you say it, you give the judge another opportunity. If you really think you're right, you give the judge another opportunity to do right. But at some point, the judge's decision as to that case, as to that level of court, is final, and there's no sense badgering the judge about it. When he makes his decision, his ruling, you got to move on. And your remedy at that point is either in an appeal, and that would come at the end of the case in most all instances, or the legislature.
Right. Okay, let's move on to the next caller. Appreciate the call. Thank you. TJ, that was. Okay, let's go to the next caller, Tim from Michigan. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Hi, this is Tim from Michigan. I was hoping to... Can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead, Tim.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you to Mr. Winters for his great teaching through these last few calls. I appreciate his knowledge and his opinions on the subject. But something I haven't heard spoken of in a while and would like some affirmation of it is the duty of the jurist to not only judge the facts in a case, but to judge the law as well. Is that something anyone can affirm? Thank you. I yield.
Well, it is the duty of the jury. It's funny that people say that we want a fully informed jury. Yes, of course, I think that's a good idea. Jury nullification, that's a good idea. But in reality, in a case where the jury has to render a verdict, they are the judges of the law. The only thing is they're not informed always of that, and so they don't realize. For example, in a murder case, the judge may say, okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to tell me what the facts of the case are, whether or not he done it, who done it, and did he do it. Okay, they'll tell you that. And then they'll say, I want you to tell me whether he gets the death penalty or whether he just gets life imprisonment. Well, that's a lot of power given to a jury in such a case. And the jury is traditionally, it's never been settled throughout the history of our common law. They just our courts have gone back and forth on this question. But one of the key points was back in the days, just before our country became a country, our country became its own country, Justice Mansfield, called the father, by the way, of the UCC, but Justice Mansfield was in a case with another justice. His name was Willis, and they both delivered opinions that were opposite, and it had to do with the jury. And the question was whether the jury had the authority to judge the law or whether they had the power to judge the law. Now, this was a long time ago. This is nothing new. Justice Mansfield said the jury has no authority to judge the law, but they do have the power to do it, and there's nothing you can do to them if they do. Well, Justice Willis said, now, wait a minute. That's senseless. If you say they have the power to do it, but they don't have the authority, but you can't punish them if they do it, well, that's inconsistent. So Justice Willis said this. He said, not only do they have the power to do it, they have the right to do it, the authority, the jurisdiction to judge the law. And that particular case, but with those two famous justices, has revealed the tone of the problem that existed before their time and exist even yet today. And here we are still arguing that point. Do they or don't they? And our common law, in its expression, has never landed conclusively. But I believe it is the consensus among most of the people that the jury has the authority, the power, because they have the authority to judge the law. And if they can't be punished, and it's clear that our common law says the jury and the juryman cannot be punished for his verdict, that's been tried through the years also, but our common law says, no, you can't do that. Well, if he can't be punished, then he does have the power, and that power rests on good authority. And the other interesting thing, a fascinating and important thing about that case was those opinions are good reading. Look them up on the Internet. Justice Mansfield, Justice Willis, I believe his name was, and the power of the jury. But those opinions do a good job of delineating and distinguishing authority from power. Authority from power. That's very important because the King James Bible, just as one example, Romans chapter 13, doesn't, in the King James translation, doesn't make that distinction. It translates their power, but the word in the Greek text is authority. There's a big difference, and that makes a big difference in the interpretation of that controversial passage that needn't be controversial if we just translate it right. Well, the same thing happened with Mansfield. So I think the consensus among people should be and is, and certainly learned justices through the years have said this, the juryman has the power and the authority to judge the law as well as the facts. And all this hallabaloo and wailing and gnashing of teeth we hear today from powerful people is wrong. And the reason they don't want the jury to be able to do that is because when the jury has power, they don't. And that's the bottom line. That's why we're having this discussion, this argument, this fight. But jury nullification is important. There are other things I could say about it, but I think we're probably dragging on too long. I think they're important to be said. Maybe we can discuss it at another time.
Okay, thank you, Tim, for your question. And we're going to take our last caller for Brent. And it's Michael from Colorado. And we'll be passing over to Gerard in a minute. Gerard, you there?
I'm not snoring yet.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Michael. What's your question for Brent?
Yes, this is for Mr. Winters. I'm Michael Hero from Colorado. I'm the rightful owner to my mother's estate. It's a probate case. It's still pending on a de facto district court here. Since 2009. Is there any way I could transfer this estate to the NLA? You mentioned in federal court. I did that. It was affirmed back in February 4th, 2014. They gave me 3 weeks to go down to the lower court and pay the $505 fee. I failed because I was pleading for my daughter.
Well, the facts of your case and the will and the law of the state of California would all figure into that. And I don't know exactly the facts of what's happening here, and I would be amiss to speculate about what you could and couldn't do.
Well, actually, the state of Colorado took it away from my siblings, and they threw a lien for $102,000. They wanted me to pay them $11,000 for a deficit. I gave them nothing. I filed a waiver with the State Recovery Program of Colorado, proving that I was a sibling, my mother's son, that I'm disabled, post-stress, a letter from my doctor, and a war letter from the Social Security indicating that X amount of dollars I get per month. That's the criteria. I met it, and the state gave it back to me, but the judge here is still trying to push this stipulation that's so unconstitutional.
Let me ask you a question here. So your mother passed away, and the probate court got involved and is trying to make settlements on your mother's estate. Is that what's going on?
Yes, my mother passed away in February 2009. Probate.
Who gave them fiduciary authority? Do you know?
Gave who? The judge.
The court.
She's She's bending every rule there is.
Yeah, but why did they take? Why are they taking control of your mother's estate? Is there a reason?
The state of Colorado. Okay, back in July, 1992, a law came in, the Reimbursement Medicaid Act came in. Medicaid wants to reimburse itself for the expense of my mother throughout the years she was under Medicaid.
Off of her estate.
Yes, off her estate. There's three ways to keep it. There's a non-claim year, which the respondents blew. They gave notice to the state. My mother died, and the state threw in a lien. And there's another way, me, I come in.
Okay, well, there are two things that have to happen, though, but you need to look into that might help you in this case. First of all, they have to have a proof of claim, and it has to be sworn to. If that doesn't exist, they have nothing. You know, they put liens on things without sworn statements, without sworn affidavits. Nobody's willing to swear to it. Every IRS case, for instance, is without a sworn affidavit. And so where is the – that's what you want to go to into this court with. You want to talk with them about where is the proof of claim. And in federal court, it's I'm not sure whether it's the 4490 or Form 56. One is a fiduciary claim and the other one is one is fiduciary authority and the other one is a proof of claim. The other thing is who's got the fiduciary – who gave them fiduciary authority over the estate? And that's another problem. They have to also – someone has to be appointed. And through that appointment, there must be sworn affidavits. There's got to be a form, one of these forms filled out, and they got to swear to it. Now, they never do this because everything they're doing generally is illegal. That's why. And that's where you want to make your battle. And if you, you can try with us, we do the habeas corpuses, and we can try to pull this case out for you if we wanted. And, they don't listen to much of anything. I don't know that we've done any probate courses, cases, but that's something you might want to consider.
The state of Colorado took it away from my special respondent, my sister, and the state of Colorado granted it back to me. I found the
Well, how many siblings do you have?
There's seven of us now.
Okay, and all seven are in agreement concerning what they want done with this estate?
All of them. It doesn't matter what they want because they could have all their wills and this and the other. The state of Colorado took it from them rightfully, and I took it rightfully from the state of Colorado because I met the criteria.
Okay. It sounds like there's a lot of things going on here that I don't really know. So I guess, here's the key thing is they in order for them to take anything from anybody, they have to have proof of claim and they have to have fiduciary authority. Without those two things, and that's just about, every time whenever the government sticks their nose into the people's business. And I'm sure there are some cases where there may be a thing, there may be something that's right where they're doing the right thing, but I haven't found that too often. So. But I don't know that we can get any more deeper than that. So I don't know, Brent. Do you have anything to add to this?
I have a little experience in the fact that they do have loopholes, but you got to jump through those hoops at the right time. Like a sibling, if a parent is going to go into a nursing home and they own a piece of property, if one of the siblings is there taking care of them for the past 2 years. That property can be put in that sibling's name, and the parent will not lose it, even though they go into a nursing home under Medicaid. But it has to be done in that time period. So there are certain things that you can meet to protect that property, but you have to do them before the fact, not after the fact. So
yeah, let me correct myself also here. We're not handling any cases unless there's an individual that's being captured, so to speak, that's involved. Right. In other words, if your mother was still alive and they were taking control of her estate and not letting the siblings do that, then that's the kind of case we get involved in. But considering the fact that now you're just fighting for the estate and they're putting claims in, what I would say to you is look for, we couldn't do a habeas corpus on that. that, so I apologize for saying that. But what you do want to look into is proof of claim and fiduciary authority required. Go down to the federal court and go into the record. Use the index number or case number that they gave you, and ask for a copy of the fiduciary authority and the proof of claim. It's Form 56 and Form 4490. Those are the two, the federal forms. And you can look them up on the Internet. Put in proof of claim or fiduciary authority, or put in those form numbers, Form 56 and Form 4490, and you'll get them. If they don't have them, you want to make a big stink about that. That's what will help you win your case.
Okay. Okay, okay. It just stuck on district court. It's been there 7-8 years. It's going nowhere.
Well, go down and find out if those two forms have been filed. I'll bet you dollars to donuts they've never been filed, and you can win your case on that. You bring that to the attention of the judge, and you demand it. And what I would do is walk into the courtroom with those forms, print them off of the Internet. You can print them right off, carry them in your hand, and walk in before the judge and let them know, hey, look, I haven't seen anybody with any fiduciary authority. There's no sworn affidavits here. Nobody filed a proof of claim. What's up with this case? See, that's where you got to go to. Now, I do know that you're saying that the state is putting a lien on this, so I don't know how all that plays. You know, now you have to go to see what sworn statement or affidavit is involved with that and who made that sworn paper. Again, you get back to the same thing, those two forms, when you're in a federal court.
The state of Colorado has nothing to do with it.
Huh?
The state of Colorado granted it back to me.
Oh, okay.
It's just
and the federal government is now involved in it. Okay, I don't know that we want to spend any more time with it, but those are the two things. You want to look for any sworn statements on the other side. If there's nothing there, they don't have a case.
Got you. I'll get back with you on that.
All right.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. All right, that was our last call for Brent. Brent, we appreciate your time with us, answering the questions and teaching with us. So let's go to move
you,
on now. Thank you. Let's move on to Gerard. Jen, did you want to make a final statement or anything?
No, that's all right.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. Okay, let's move on. Gerard, you've got the mic. I'm going to take a short break, so I'm not going to be at the mic for a little while, but I'll be back in a few. But go right ahead. You're on the board. You got the board too, right?
Yeah,
Jen, don't talk
to
me. See if I care.
I do. I don't know if anybody else got in the queue.
Yeah, there's a couple of people in the queue now.
Well, that's Michael from Colorado. We just got rid of that. That's who we just talked to.
Right.
Michael. So then it's Pennsylvania Mary.
Yeah, anybody else who wants to get into the queue, *6, please.
The next one.
Okay.
Mary, you've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Am I muted?
Yes, you are.
I'm there now. Okay, thanks.
You're unfitted, right.
I'm und. Okay. Regarding such as Stephen from Colorado, is that what that gentleman's name was?
From Colorado? I think it was Michael.
Michael, okay. Forgive me. Senior moment. Just to pass this along, some of the stuff, guys, that I ended up being inadvertently learning from personal experience. While you all are very honorable and doing the lawful approach in everything that you're doing, just know that those that it's going to have zero honor. They don't care that you're being honorable or that you're doing the lawful thing. I'm not telling you don't do it. I'm letting you know that is how it is perceived. It doesn't matter. They're totally renegade to what is going on. I've had someone that I was helping through the years going back to 2002, 3, 4, a senior, my best friend from childhood's mother. I didn't realize at the time, but that is exactly what they were doing, was stealing her estate. And that is what they did. And I won't get into any more with that. I've got someone else that I actually tried to hook her into the NLA when she told me what was going on with her mother. last year. Her mother has since passed, but her mother was medically kidnapped. Her mother had a workman's comp claim, and I believe that they harvested an organ from their mother. It's another convoluted case. I've had the law, the system, myself, take my own house, my property. They took it all through the system. We would be notified after the fact. We wouldn't be given an opportunity to submit an affidavit. We would be provided with a court order after they went and did it. They'd falsify documents and put it through the court system. We even hired a lawyer that is part of the whole game. And all it did is accomplish extorting an extra $600 a month out of us. They put us up on foreclosure, private sale. We never defaulted. So don't just assume because everybody is doing things legally and lawfully and this is the right thing and this is what our Constitution says. They don't care.
Well, look at
they're not doing it.
The big thing, look at, and we know there's a lot of corruption, and like you've just reiterated, there, you know, they don't. There's no place they won't go when there's money involved. Now, one of the tools that you have to understand is you have to get things on the record, and it's hard. You know, they like to falsify the record, but it's very important, and it takes a certain skill to get things on the record. Let the record show. You know, when we were in court early on, we would throw things in after, you know, we'd put papers in, memorandums of law and all these other things we would file. And what really unnerved them is all that stuff was going on the record. And that's what they get nervous about. Now, the other thing is, you know, when you don't take an attorney, they don't like you when you don't take an attorney. Well, number one is it puts a lot more stress on the judge because now it's his responsibility to make sure the attorneys don't take advantage of you. And he doesn't like to be in the position where he's protecting you because you're pro se or sudi juris, whatever you want to call yourself. So they always try to push this counsel on you. We were helping one guy and he didn't want the counsel and they kept insisting. And he finally called the sheriff and said, look, I want an order of protection. This guy, I don't want him within 50 feet of me because he kept showing up in the court. And he's like, he's not my attorney and I don't want him. And they just insisted on giving him somebody because the judge was so overly sensitive to him, you know, maybe making a claim later on that the judge didn't protect him. And the other thing that's going on is these judges, especially on the federal level, don't have a taste for doing their job anymore. They shirk their responsibility and they're sending things down to the state courts all the time. And many times it's cases that should not be decided by the state courts. There's certain cases that are supposed to be decided because they're constitutional issues by the Supreme Court. And when they don't do their job, they create all kinds of havoc for we the people. Because like the one case John and I was reading, it was the guy went up against the 14th Amendment and they sent it back down to the state. And when the state, of course, didn't have a good outcome for it. And what he said, look, you federal judges are going to create a revolution because by not doing your job and sending it back to the state, these issues that are supposed to be decided on the federal level, you're going to create a situation where in one state the 14th Amendment is going to be constitutional and in the other state it's not going to be. There will be fights then. And so, you know, I think he nailed it pretty good. The fact that they are not doing their job and they're always looking to get out of things and they really don't have a stomach for it. Everything has to be clean. That's why they like their statutes so much. So when you go, like Brent says, when you go into court, it's a battle. You have to know that you're having a battle, and it's a war. It's really a war.
Mm-hmm.
And then, how do you get all these things on the record? You gotta be.
Sure, I'm just trying to pass on. I understand this.
Well,
we
I'm just saying
never,
it for all
Gerard,
the people
Gerard, Gerard, since 2012, since 2012, we've never had a day in court.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to tell you that they're renegade. The same thing has happened with this young woman. 5 years they had her mother. The courts appointed, they gave somebody custody of this, an adult woman with four children. They took her mother, who was 53 years of age.
Well,
while she was in the hospital, they took custody of her. They gave custody to the daughters, and took and appointed a trustee of the mother's estate, and wouldn't pay the mother's bills. The daughters still went around it. So I'm just trying to say, even though everybody that I hear with the NLA is so honorable and doing things by the book and that are lawful, and I'm just saying, don't just look in that capacity. You have to look beyond that. Even though you go and you do things and do the filings, look beyond to see what else they could be doing. They have done so much to my husband and I, and we didn't know about it until after the fact.
Right.
There are court orders with totally falsified documents. I have the contradictory documents. A judge stamped a court order. We found out about the court order on a foreclosure on our house 3 months after this judge did it.
Yeah, and that's
so I'm telling you that, and this is, they're doing it, they're running it rampant. I know who the attorney is that's under scrutiny right now, so I don't want to go any more than that.
Right, because
but
you get
doing
into
a whole lot. Right.
But
Jersey and Pennsylvania, there is someone very specific that they are aware has been wreaking havoc, but the courts are all going along with him, and people aren't being told stuff. Oh, they're being served sheriff's notices.
Look, the best you can do is try to, the truth prevails if you can proclaim it. Now, what I'm saying is you have to figure out how to proclaim it the best you can, get it on the record. You know, you have to be very good. You got to be able to put a judge in the suit without really getting held in contempt. It's a dance. It's a dance. It's a ballet. You got to know what you're doing, and it doesn't always work. If you're a target, they're going to keep coming after you. Sheriff Arpaio is a target, and he's done very well holding him off. And the reason he can hold him off is because he's popular and he has a lot of support, and that's what holds them back. When you go in these courts alone with no support, you're out there doing battle without armor and maybe without even any ammunition. So I understand what you're up against.
Yeah, and
I understand how it works, and it's not easy. And court is a show, and the best thing you can do is put a good show on. But once you lose it, and once you get a target on you, or once they think that you're cuckoo because you're making all these claims, you're done. You know what I mean?
But here's who the targets are. In addition to who you've said, just as they've targeted the ranchers and the farmers, mm-hmm. they've targeted seniors. They're stealing their properties in estate.
Because they expect it's going to be easy. That's why.
They are doing it, and here's
the
family. Because
the senior doesn't have the wherewithal to stand up to them, and that's the case.
Well, families don't know how to handle the estate either.
No,
they're doing it after people are dead.
Right.
They are killing people.
Well,
they are doing this to us. This is not.
This is not a time for
anybody who's honorable to turn a blind eye and a deaf ear. This is going on. Listen
Kennedy
to the whistleblowers.
Said,
they're coming forward.
Right, and that's all you can hope for. It's going to take divine intervention. And Kennedy said those that don't let peaceful revolution take place, you make bloody revolution inevitable. And so, you know, that's where we're at. And
there really are people who have that are now stepping up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking people that are part of the system that have gone along with things, had no idea truly of what they were going along with.
Right.
And these people are awakening.
I'm
talking in the line of politicians. Mm-hmm. They're awakening to, oh, my God. How did I do this? Well, they know that they've done wrong. They're terrified. They are absolutely terrified, and it goes all the way up. Listen, it's only those at the very tippy top of the food chain that know the whole agenda. I've been communicating with someone because I've known them my whole life. They are flabbergasted with the things
look
that
at
I've shared.
Snake, the snake is eating its tail, too, now, because people that are in the system are getting bit by the system. And so you are going to have more whistleblowers. And all we can hope is that it does reach a critical mass. And that's all I can say about that.
Absolutely, you know. Gerard. And, you know, it's like, and then I'll get off after this. It is like our police where I live, okay? I can only speak specifically.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be here when it hits the fan. They're going to be at home taking care of their own families. Okay? This is
Absolutely.
Not my opinion. This is not my opinion, and I was guided and directed to make sure that I have for myself. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, because I was going, well, that's what you guys are for. What do I need protection? Why do I need home defense? That's what you're for. And the looks that I would get, and they said, no, we're not. They are not going to be here. Well, if it hits the fan, they're going to be my neighbors. We better start doing something now.
Because we have
organizing as communities,
telling people to arm themselves. Because look at you know, the cops get there after the fact, so it's your responsibility.
They're not
going
to be there. That's what I'm trying to tell you. They've already told me.
If it's look in Katrina, they weren't there either because they didn't make provisions to take care of their family, so they're not going to show up for work. We understand that, and so
correct.
Yeah, that's
but that's not who's being paid to.
I understand, but look at the man is going to take care of his family first. If
that's
his
correct.
His wife and kids are going to die. He doesn't care what he's getting paid. All that goes out the window. And so if they don't make sure that who's ever working for them's families are taken care of first, they're not going to be there. And I look at the whole system is dysfunctional, it's criminal, and it's going to fall under its own weight. I have a confidence in this because I see it every day. They've hired a dumbed down workforce. They've dumbed us down, and then they're forced to hire us dumbed down people. So they're very dysfunctional, and they're starting to reap what they sowed, and that's all I can say about that. So you're right. I mean, I don't think it's going to be too much longer before you start seeing the changes, and hopefully we can come out of it with a soft landing, and it doesn't have to go to some kind of crazy bloody wreck.
And that's what I'm trying to share with you is that I have been working that angle.
Right.
I have not approached them about a committee yet, but it is time for me to do that.
Yes, and that's the whole.
You know what? Community. They're going to be responsive, even if it's with their own little block.
Right.
And we don't have blocks. I mean, this was all farmland, so
right.
there's a little bit of space here.
But you got it. That's what you do. You get together with your community. That's the whole idea behind the committees of safety, and that's really the answer. It really is because, you know, if you can't depend on your neighbors, then you're done. And you can't be an island. No man's an island. So, anyway, that being said, I want to move forward. We've got a lot of people in the queue. We've been quite a while. Anyway, so thank you
for
that.
Go ahead. Thank you so very much. Yeah. I appreciate it. And, yes, question and challenge everything.
Right.
Is really the bottom line, Michael, with regards to what they're dealing with.
Yeah.
They are doing this across the country, and it isn't my opinion. I'm passing on what I know factually.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much for that.
All right. Good night now.
Good night. Okay, Kansas Jan, it says.
Yeah. I just wanted to tell the lady that was on before that, yes, I agree with everything she said, and they're doing it here in Kansas, too, and that I was involved with something like that with my mother and became a target for not euthanizing her. I fought the medical system for 7 years on her behalf and did become a target, and I'm still one. But my question was, Gerard, about that money that Kieran Hudis had told us about. I'd heard her on a radio station or two, and then since the last time, I think you talked about it a couple weeks ago, I have heard on a couple of other radio stations that, I'm not sure I can say this right, and I'm only going to make a comment, and I'd like your comment about it, but I've heard that it's gold-backed currency, and the reason that Russia and China are involved in it is because it is the one world currency, and that we will be able to turn this currency in for digital money at our bank at a higher rate than the paper currency with gold in it. So we'll be given paper currency with gold in it, and then we'll turn it into the bank, and we'll get, say, if you turn in $100, you'll get $140 in digital money. Now, I don't know whether I've got that right, and these people didn't know whether they had it right either, but it's kind of the scuttlebutt. So I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Yes, thank you very much. And look, I'm no expert, and don't forget, this is a multi-headed hydra that's going down. You know, they're not going to go down without a fight. Now, the little bit that I do know, one thing I know is the New World Order doesn't like gold money. They don't like a cap on money. They want to be able to create money out of thin air and put interest on it, because then you end up with slavery. That's what it's all about, ultimately, keeping us slaves. So the Russia and the BRICS nations have put together this basket of currency that is a commodity-backed money. Now, the IMF has something called special drawing rights. That's the New World Order. That's the stuff that they're gonna try to take this gold money and turn it to digital money. That's gonna, you know, we need to educate ourselves, because I don't care if they're gonna buy us off. If you take that gold money and you turn it into digital money, then shame on you, because it's only worth more that month, that week, until they fractionalize it and lend it out 100-to-1 like they did, and do the whole stupid thing all over again. It's like Brent says, they're still operating from the same playbook. They're always doing the same thing. It's very easy to see what they're doing, and so we should be able to resist it. Now, if they're going to give you $140 for $100, look, at that $40 is only going to last until they get everybody on, and it's going to disappear. You know, they're going to take it out. They're going to go back to the same thing, and then you're going to have this system that your cabal families will be still running our money. And if people aren't educated enough to understand and see that, then woe is to us. So, you know, and you know, they keep mixing stuff. Oh no, it's this one, it's that one. He's over here, he's over there. It's Russia, it's China, it's this. Look at I do know is China's holding an awful lot of our toxic debt. We sold it to them. Obama and Clinton had promised them our resources as backing to that, which is a problem for us, because they didn't have the authority to do that. It's a wonder that we haven't been hit with some kind of nuclear bomb for all the nasty things that we have done in the world with the money system between Russia and China and our economic hitmen that we sent over there to take over their stuff and their resources. We've been all, and it's not us, it's not the American people, it's these corporate entities that are in the American government that have been here since the beginning. It's the USA Inc. Incorporated, which happened in 1912 or 13 or whatever it was, and they've been operating here doing this from the beginning, and it's time for us to shake them off and throw them off and get back to that original Constitution. You know, that's therein is the problem, and you're going to hear a lot of misinformation, a lot of confusion, because, you know, that's what they need to do. Look, they're fighting for their lives right now. Their system is shaken, and it was designed to do this, too. They knew there would be a shakeup, and they knew that they would throw all these people that facilitated their control under the bus, and that's supposed to get us all depressed and shocked and awed, and so that we stand there and wring our hands. And what they want is they want a failure of the system, so the food goes off the shelves, and people panic, and this reset never happens. And then they can come in and make things really, really bad to where the people will accept any kind of totalitarian government, as long as they get rid of the anarchy and any kind of, you know, any stuff that's going on as far as, you know, people stealing and running around with, you know, doing anarchist things. Now, that's up to us. You see, if we don't panic and we stick together in communities, we have committees of safeties, none of that stuff's going to work. Their dream is going to fizzle. When we protect each other in our communities, and of course it's much harder in the cities, but I don't see why the cities can't do like a neighborhood watch thing and pool their resources. Look at, they should all be buying stuff and getting ready for hard times. The cities can get ready too, you know, and we have enough country in this world to support probably 6 times the population we have now. You know, but we don't do it because you have groups like Monsanto that are working against us that don't want it to happen because they want to control the profits. So look at this whole business of getting with your neighbors, the committees of safety. This is what's important to preach right now, you know. And you could do some gold and silver right now. Get some alternative money. And you should keep some cash on hand because people are still going to, in the beginning, you're going to need those Federal Reserve notes. People aren't going to get right away. As a matter of fact, the ones that are going to realize our money's worth nothing is the foreigners. You're not going to be able to do any trade outside of America after a while. And eventually, the people will figure out in America that the money's worth nothing. And that's when they'll be wallpapering their walls with it. But until that happens, it still will be valuable to us. You'll still be able to get some goods and services with it. So you should try to get out of digital money. You should try to get your monies out of the bank. And you should be storing some stuff like food and dry goods and things like that. That's just prudent. You know, I think the Seventh-day Adventists, they have a rule that they're supposed to have 2 years of supplies stacked up. That's not a bad idea, you know. So, that's where it's going to go. And we know that this money system is against a brick wall right now. We know it. There's no voodoo here. Look at when your gross national product and your interest on your debt, you know, don't line up and you can't make your payment. Guess what? It's tilt. It's game over. And that's where we're at. We're at game over. We've been at game over for 6 months. I don't know how they're holding it together, but they are. And I know they haven't met their timeline, and I know that their plans haven't. A lot of their plans have been stymied, but they're very tenacious, and they insist on marching forward. It's going to be up to us to stymie their plans by us cooperating with each other instead of fighting. And that's what they want. They want chaos, and out of chaos, they'll institute their new world order. Just remember that. So people need to not panic. They need to have a plan, and they need to talk to their neighbors. You got to get the committees of safety going.
Just a couple more things that I heard that I'm just going to pass on, and then, you know, is that I heard that already over 100 nations will not take our currency, and that that there has already been the food stamps. I heard this on Alex Jones, so it's probably true. That the food stamps, some of the people that got food stamps, their food stamps were already late last month by 2 or 3 weeks, and they were panicking. So it looks like it probably will be the food that they use. And then the other thing, I just wanted to say to the older people of us that I wonder if they're not trying to take our resources, meaning the older people's, like the retired people's homes and stuff, as the resources, because like some people have farms and that kind of thing that was passed on to them. So that was all I wanted to say. I'll get off now. Thanks, Gerard. I really appreciate all your information.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to take everything. They're going to take bank accounts. They're going to take 401ks. Look at as this. We're already in receivership. We're already defunct and broke and We've already defaulted on our debt. So don't, you know, it's only a matter of time to see the results of that. So it's up to us how we get through this now. So just rest assured that you need to be taking steps now, and that, you know, we'll get through it as long as we cooperate. Anyway, I'm going to move on to the next question. Thank you. I don't know who this is. It looks like 9138.
Hey, yeah, I guess it's going around again. How you doing?
Good. Who's this? What's your name?
This First is Danny. Time. Danny.
Okay.
Danny
okay.
from New York.
Yeah.
I was just listening, and yeah, I kind of like, I hear all the panic in people's voices, and you know, I see that going on, but you know, you said something before that was pretty key to you know, kind of go in like you're going like you said, it's like a battle. And if you watch, like, the UFC or anything, the guys that go in calm and aren't affected by the crowd, they usually, mm-hmm. they perform well. They don't let, they you know, they walk in. they walk into the lion's den, and they're not intimidated. And you said something key before, that the outcome is not in our hands.
Mm-hmm.
Doing the right thing is.
That's right. Yeah, I think Brent said that quite a bit too. And you're absolutely right. Now look, at court is a show, so the best showman will win. Look, we've had guys that went in that were very schooled and very articulate, and the DA turned around and shook their hand and said, "I've never heard anybody be so articulate," and they actually end up liking you. So if you conduct yourself in a proper way, you can win the court over. You can't, look at, don't forget, they're only men, and this courtroom, it's a show. It's a movie. You're putting on a play.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I understand they have guns and they're going to hold you in contempt and all this other stuff. But, you know, it's bad when people go in and they don't know what they're doing, because it gives a bad name to, you know, the whole common law thing. You know, when people don't know how to act or they go in there and they're arrogant and they really don't have a lot of credibility, and they're just looking to make trouble. Of course, the judges are looking to get rid of them. You know, they don't. None of the judges want to go to trial if they can help it. They always want out of court settlements. And you know, when you're writing your papers, that's another thing, is you want to try to leave them a way out. Because if you corner them, you put them in the corner, and you really nail them, and they think that you're going to go after them, and they're going to end up in jail. They're going to do whatever they can to get rid of you before you get rid of them. So you have to have a door that they can exit. You know, you have to make it easy for them to give you the win. You got to let that judge have something to hang his hat on, you know. And part of the trick is putting him in a horn dilemma between defending the lower court judge and defending himself. And every time he's going to defend himself. So if you can set up that dilemma for him, you know, then you can prevail, you know. And you know, it takes a lot of moxie, you know, because sometimes you're over there disqualifying the judge. You know, if you're opening up a court of record and you're asking for a jury, that's different, because you're going in as a plaintiff and not a defendant. There's a big difference. So there's an art to it. It's not only just facts. It's an art form, you know what I mean? And so that's what you need to practice, and not everybody can do it. Look, people need counsel. There's no doubt about it. Not everybody can write papers and stand up in front and talk in a court. Not everybody has that ability. And even Thomas Jefferson, who was a wonderful writer, I understand that he wasn't a very good orator.
He hated speaking in public.
Yeah, he hated speaking. And I mean, look at the words that came off of his pen. I mean, my goodness, you would think that, you know. And on the flip side of that is somebody like Patrick Henry. I don't know if you've ever read his whole speech. Everybody remembers the part where he says, "Give me liberty or give me death." But there was a whole lot more he said before that. And if you read that thing, it sounds just like today. He's like, "How much longer are you going to wait?" You know, he says, "They're forging your chains. When are we going to be more ready to fight? Tomorrow, next week, after they take our guns?" You know, it was a very heartfelt speech that really turned them and made them steel themselves into this revolution. And he was a very powerful speaker. And that's the difference in men right there. Anyway.
Hey, I got a quick question for you. I'm sorry, Jared is. Hello.
Yeah.
Jared. Your name's Jared.
Gerard. Yeah.
Gerard. Okay, Danny. You sound a little like Brett, and I thought Brett was back in the line. maybe my ears are going bad.
No, my throat's getting a little hoarse, so I just had to take a drink. But that means I'm talking too much. Go ahead.
Hi, Fred. I'll give you a little bit about my situation. I'm going into court. It's been a lot of. I mean, it is art form. It's trickery. It's total fraud. The judge, in this case, I brought it to the Court of Appeals, and I trusted in counsel. I'm out of money. I had to rely on assigned counsel. So, and I asked to file supplemental briefs to the appellate division. In New York, you go to the appellate division, then you go to the Court of Appeals, but only like 7% of the cases last year were heard by the Court of Appeals. So, and now I'm looking at the findings of fact of the decision that the judge made. I'm going over them. And it said, the facts of the case are based on a police report that I'm not even mentioning.
Well, look, let me stop you right there. Let me tell you what your problem is. I mean, before you go into a big thing with the state, first of all your problems are due process. And they're all violating your unalienable rights, and you're never going to get remedy in the state court. The state's never going to stick the finger in their eye and pluck their own eye out, which is basically when you're fighting in the state court. You see, they don't even have jurisdiction over these issues because most of them are constitutional issues that you're babbling with. If you don't take them into the federal court,
that's what I'm referring at the clerk's office today at the federal court. But I'm facing a contempt charge.
Yeah, you have to be careful. That's a problem. And the thing is, you know, and like I said, you got to be savvy and you got to be willing to put the judge's skin on the line and you need to get it out of the state court, but yet you got to be able to navigate in the federal court in such a way that you get maybe get some relief by setting up a horn dilemma for the judge where he wants to get rid of the case and he tells them get settle with this guy, get him out of here. Because he's not going to stick his neck out for a lower state court judge. That's your only recourse, really.
Right. There's two cases going on here. There's a custody battle between a non-parent and a biological parent who has not been found to be unfit through due process, which is that's never been. It's been assumed, which is shown in case law before at the federal level, Stanley versus the state of Illinois, that an unwed father has to be shown by clear and convincing evidence to be unfit before he could take his parental rights away. So, but that was pushed over. So now, then I get attacked from another side because who am I to step up and want to be a father to my son and want to, you know, share my experience with him and be involved in his education and his every aspect of his life. And there's a non-parent that is stepping in and it's a lot of money and pull in the community. And the case, the her attorneys that for 3 years have been postponing this, and judges have retired, called mistrials and removed themselves from the case. Now this judge, they come up and they say that we donated too much money. This is 6 months into the case with postponements and a bunch of false allegations. 6 months in, they say, we donated too much money to this judge's campaign, that was last November, and they donated the money. I just got it from the Board of Elections in August.
We got other callers, and we only got a
few minutes left. So.
Yeah.
Maybe you just finalize on the call, and we'll move to the next person, maybe.
Yeah.
So what is the purpose of this call then? I mean,
call ultimately is to save the nation. I mean, we're doing things in the court.
You can't save the nation.
People in a general way, though. Go ahead.
You can't save the nation without like Brett said before on the phone, every case is different.
Well, you're absolutely right, but the key thing is this, you know, we're dealing with subversion against the United States of America, and that's what the important cases are that we're dealing with in the courts. We are dealing also with what took place in Oregon, because that is a focused case for us, and it proves the subversion against the people. also we're dealing with, we're trying to help people and also building a case against the judiciary at this point in time by doing habeas corpuses and these people coming in and blocking them. I mean, the chief judges in these courts are blocking these habeas corpuses. So when someone is going to jail or is in jail or maybe going to jail, we will have, be able to help them, but we don't want to get too much into the case. The
yeah,
key to
no
all these cases, there's two things that are keys to this case, these cases, two things, jurisdiction, okay, and due process. They don't have jurisdiction, and they never give you due process, and that's where the battle is, and we say that about just about every case we do and assist you. And that's maybe, well, it's, I'm sure it's the same thing with you. And if you are facing jail, if you're in a court system and you're facing jail, the threat of jail is looming over you, the end results, they're coming after you, the end results is jail, you're probably going to end up in jail because they usually win. Very rarely do the people win. Well, then that's something we would do a habeas corpus for you.
Well, how does a habeas corpus work? Because that's what the clerk at the federal courthouse told me for the Southern District.
Well, look, at you, what you would do, basically a habeas corpus requires them to show cause of your potential incarceration or your incarceration. Look, at if you're being held into a court, you're incarcerated, so to speak. You're being held. So if you have to show up for court and you don't show up, they're going to arrest you. So therefore, you are being held by the court. So you want to be let loose from the court. And you do a habeas corpus, and they got 3 days to answer the papers for the habeas corpus. And if they fail to answer, it goes to default, and then they have to release you. Now, we've had, out of 28 cases, we've had 3 people released, but that's it. But that's a good, actually, you know, you don't hear about habeas corpuses, and you never hear about people getting released from habeas corpus. So actually, that's a pretty good success margin. But basically, some of these other cases that we haven't had success with doesn't mean we're not going to have success. It doesn't mean that the further things we're doing in the courts, like this paper we're sending out to the courts this week, this puts more pressure on them. This may cause some of these judges to decide to do the right thing and set these people free. Also, when we get to the other side, immediately we're going to move forward to secure all these habeas corpuses and make sure these people are freed. So, you know, that's the benefit of doing one, of course. So that's what you might want to do. Go read the papers under help and fill out the form, and we'll help you.
All right, John, real quick, jurisdiction. I've been very, very – I've been studying a couple of documents.
By the way, I just want to make this one note because it's getting late, but we're going to go a few minutes over. I do want to respond back to this guy, Michael. I was thinking about Michael from Colorado in his case. I have something that I think is pretty important to say about that case. But go right ahead. Go back. Back to you.
Okay. Mike, stay on the line. Don't get off. In the Third Amendment, which says, you can't soldiers cannot quarter themselves in a home during time of peace or in time of war, but as prescribed by the law. Now, when they declare war on drugs, war on domestic violence, war on whatever, is that time of war? I mean, logically?
Well, it's BS is what it is. You can't declare war on drugs.
But that's what I'm saying. I mean, how can these questions not be addressed directly. And there's one in the rules of professional conduct, which they've made law, rule 1.6 in every state. It's the same in every, it's the confidentiality of information. Now, it reads like this, and this is the oath they take. They uphold the Constitution of the United States, Constitution of the state, and the rules of professional conduct. Look up rule 1.6 in every state. Very, very, very weird. It says confidentiality of information. Information is confidential in relation to the representation of a client. That's like everyone in the courtroom, including the judge. Only way, anyone member of the bar can use their discretion to break it, but they have to prove that it's going to result in imminent bodily injury or imminent death, or in the continuance of a crime. So if the judge commits a crime in the courtroom and the door closes, there's no continuance of a crime. And how do you, life in prison is not even, I mean, that's not even considered bodily injury or imminent death.
Well, look, you know, this whole system is upside down, and we got to fix it. That's what we're here for.
But
that's what we the people are trying to do.
If you bring up Rule 1.6, they immediately shut up. The lawyers band together like a pack of wolves. They won't talk to you.
Yeah, I don't know what Rule 1.6 is, but, you know, I don't know. It's getting late, and I do want to make a final comment about Michael's case. Do you want to – what is Rule 1.6?
Rule 1.6 is the confidentiality of information.
I don't know exactly what you're trying to say, but it sounds like we're going to have a little bit more of a lengthy dialogue in order for me to understand what you're talking about, because the
lawyers
question
are not
is
allowed
what
to
is
tell
information,
on each other.
What information are you going
to Lawyers are not allowed to tell on each other or a judge, which is all district attorneys.
Well, again, that's a fraud, okay? That's fraud.
Absolutely. It's a conflict of interest.
So there's
no
sense.
It's a complete conflict of interest.
But, right, and it's a fraud.
Now, this is gentleman right here.
They won't be able to do that, okay?
John, listen to this. Listen to what there's a lawsuit going on right now. And the gentleman explains that the United States is not the government. He said the United States is – the government is contracted.
I'd like to talk to you about this, but, again, we're going to get into another subject matter. We're over time by 6 minutes, and I still have something else I want to bring up. So why don't you bring this up next Monday, get on early enough on the call to ask the questions, and let's talk, okay?
All right.
On that issue, because that sounds like an interesting issue. But with that said, I just want – go ahead, Gerard. You want to finalize
If he reads that paper that we wrote tonight, he's going to understand we're already there, where the government is not the government that we think it is. That paper is about that, okay?
You hire a roofer to put a roof on your house. That roofer is not your house.
Right.
Right.
I understand.
Okay.
So we're there with you.
Let me go back. I want to share something. This is, I think, pretty important. You know, this guy, Michael, that was, I think he was from Colorado, and, yeah. You know, little things, I was thinking about what he had said, and if I could have probed a little more, we could have understood a little more. But, you know, we don't really have the time on this program to go into those details, and people really often don't want to listen to all those details. But generally speaking, those are the things we want to talk about. You know, talk about due process, talk about jurisdiction, fiduciary authority, proof of claim. These are all important subject matters that everyone should know, and we can talk about them as often as we can. And generally speaking, every case goes to those areas over and over and over again. It doesn't get any more difficult than that in today's environment because they violate everything. But anyway, I realized that this guy Michael had mentioned the fact that he had already won, that the state has already awarded him this, okay? Which means, I perceive, this battle has already been done in the state. Now, this is now in federal court. Now, how did they get into federal court? There's a couple of problems here. Number one, they have to have a federal issue. If the state court has made a decision, just because the state all of a sudden wants to come in and go into the federal court, it seems like they've gotten into the federal court because they are the state, and not that they have the authority to get into the state. That might be one of the reasons why these judges are recusing themselves. There's other things involved here, okay? There's the ex post facto. The fact that they're chasing money. You know, are they chasing the money? When did this law come into effect? Did this law come into effect after his mother died? Did this law come into effect just a month before his mother died? Are they trying to get the money that it would fall under after the law became effective for a short period of time, or are they trying to go back and get everything? Okay. The other thing is why would one person have to pay and another person doesn't? That's another thing that, you know, either they have a situation. All this medical coverage and stuff shouldn't be anyway, okay? If we had a healthy economic system, none of the people would have a problem with dealing with their health. We'd all be able to pay for our own health care and because we'd have enough money to do so because we would be a rich people again. You know, if you look at the relationships of salaries for people per capita, and you look in different areas, like let's take New York City. You know, back when a dollar was a dollar, we had silver, we had real dollars, you know. The people in the early 1900s, you know, the salaries they were getting were equal to about $70,000 a year in salaries today. So people were much richer. I mean, you go down into the Bronx, you go to Brooklyn, Queens, but I can tell you more about the Bronx. You know, building after building after building after building, you walk into these buildings, every building has this big most every building anyway, have these big receiving halls, and it's all marble. Beautiful stuff, high ceilings, everything's gorgeous, seating and places for mirrors and flower arrangements and different things, just in a hall of an apartment building, okay? And we're not talking about the super rich here. We're talking about the common building. You know, as far as an apartment building is concerned, at least that's the way it was in the Bronx. You go up University Avenue out into the Grand Concourse, down to Burnside or Tremont. I mean, for anybody that comes from the Bronx, it knows those areas. But so money was different then. But bottom line, ultimately, okay, is that this court system that is coming in after this guy, you know, that the reason why, let's go back to what we're really talking about, is these judges seem to be recusing themselves. I think he said he's been in court for 8 years or something, or it's been going on for 8 years, and I'm sure some of that time was in the state court. Why are they recusing themselves? I think because ultimately these judges are afraid to make the decision, mostly because they don't have the jurisdiction, okay, number one. Also, and the state doesn't belong in there. I mean, they have to have for the state to move a court case into the federal courts, they have to have they have to give the jurisdiction to the federal court because they have to have a cause to be able to do that. And the cause generally is an unalienable right cause. Well, the state doesn't have unalienable rights, so they can't move into the courts under the Bill of Rights. I mean, what possibly could they have moved into the court for? I think that's why these judges are recusing themselves. He needs to bring that to light, the fact that they don't even belong in this federal court, the fact that also he needs to look a little deeper into this time period of when this law came into effect, and are they, you know, is there an ex post facto problem here where they're trying to go back and collect everything from way back when? So that's what I think is really going on. And there's no way that that the state has done a fiduciary, filled out any fiduciary authority. Oh, that was the other one. Look at, if they have a lien, where did they get the lien from? If the state didn't, if the state courts didn't award them a lien, by what authority do they think they can go and put a lien? Now, the state does that often. The IRS does liens. You know, towns do liens by going after your property and different things like that when they have no authority or right to do a lien. So that's the other big question. Look, at a lien, the only time you could do a lien that I know of without going into a court, okay, is a mechanics lien. And those falls under a certain criteria, and certainly the state doesn't fall under anything that they can file a mechanics lien against somebody. So they don't have that authority to file a lien. And if no court gave them a lien, then they don't have a lien. They can't have. You have to have a lien that has to come from the court. They have to give you a judgment, and therefore you have a lien. So there, again, is another problem. They're battling over a lien that doesn't exist. And again, another problem for the judge, because if this individual, Michael, is making certain arguments, whether he realizes or not, he may be touching very sensitive areas, which really brings you to these points. And this is why the judges are recusing themselves. And this is why it's going on and on and on. He needs to settle it up and bring it right to the – he's got to bring that right up into the court, straight out, and look for the answer. And move the court. Don't ask the court. Don't pray the court. Don't beg the court. Move the court to dismiss this case and throw out this lien.
I'll bet you if they're doing a lien, it's an in rem lien, which they don't have the authority to do. That needs to be done.
Yeah, that's the only way they can do it, yes.
Right. So if it's an in rem lien they did on him, they can't do it at the state level. Like you said, they don't have those papers filed in the federal court. And reading through their procedures, they're supposed to arrest the property with a U.S. government official, somebody that works, not the state. It has to be done by the U.S. government. So you know they didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he's going to get them, I think. I think that he brings that up, I think they're done.
All right, with that brings us to the end of our program. I don't know where my mouse went to. Let me see if it fell on the floor. Oh, yeah, it did fall on the floor. Hang on a second. All right, we're way, way over time, so apologize that we couldn't get to everybody. But I want to thank everyone for coming, and Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. And remember, this Thursday, you know, we're going to have a meeting like we do every Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here for the purpose of organizing the people across the country in order to take back our country, take back our courts, take back our nation. And so everyone should be involved. Now is the time. The clock is ticking. The hourglass is almost empty. We need to move now. There is no time to lose. So please, everybody, get involved. Come meet with us on Thursday, and let's make a plan. Okay. Good night, everybody. Thanks for coming.
Nothing's good that yours is bad. The heat goes on and it drives you mad. Scornful thoughts that fly your way, you should turn away, 'cause there's nothing more to say. Nothing gained.